There'll be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be daring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey, an actor!
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie
starring everybody
and me. There'll be heroes bold, there'll be comedy, and a lot of fuss that is for us so happily.
Hey, an actor!
We can watch it on develop
starring everybody
and Danny DeVito!
Hello, one and all, and welcome back to Hey An Actor, your seasonable podcast about actors and films that they are in. I am one half of the brothers Wilson, my name's Ian, and I'm here with the other half of the brothers Wilson, it's Pandy.
Hello, children. Welcome to the wonderful world of Hey An Actor. Ding, 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 ding. What's that? An alert? Ding, 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 ding. That's right. It's another episode.
Yes.
Let's all say episode.
Episode.
You sign. Episode. Anyway. Sorry, you just had like a children's TV presenter there for a moment.
That's fine. Anything to freshen up the image.
Absolutely. I'm wearing these dungarees.
I was wearing a mask last week for no reason. But
I put on a mask. Lingy, lingy.
Yes, this is the In Jokes podcast. two brothers who need to really up their work rate, frankly. But
well, here we are.
Yep, that's right. We've having got out our end of year Christmas special in February 2026. We're now trying to get this done before the end of March, so that we can get back onto more of an even keel.
And yeah.
If you haven't listened to the podcast before, we usually try and make the first brand new episode of a year to be more about an actor who's more associated with comedy. And for that reason, we've gone for everyone's favourite foul-mouthed gnome, Danny DeVito.
Foul-mouthed gnome?
You heard me. And we will be covering three of his films, the format being we will cover a film that I had not seen before, a film that Pandy had not seen before, and then a film that either neither of us or both of us had seen before. Or some kind of weird split, but one that was chosen by the forums. So today's offering, because, well, you know, you've heard a lot of nonsense via our Facebook page and everything like that. And
I've had fun on the Facebook page.
We'll drop in, you know, oblique references to what we've been up to hither and thither throughout the episode. So, yeah, so more about my face later on. But on a Batman villain theme, Danny DeVito, of course, the Penguin.
Right.
We're not actually covering Batman Returns. We are covering, as our premiere feature presentation, the adaptation of, Roald Dahl.
Noted anti-Semite.
His famous book, Matilda.
Indeed.
Of which he both directed and co-starred.
And narrated.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that, certainly. And then before that, we will go for the film that Pandy had never seen before, prior to preparing for this specific episode. And that is the 1980s adventure film, Romancing the Stone.
Romance and a Hance.
Indeed. Again, new mouth. But
new mouth who dis.
Exactly. Ladies, we are going to start off today with the film that I had previously not seen before. It is the 1999 Andy Kaufman biopic, Man on the Moon.
Hello, I am Andy.
I want to be the biggest star in the world.
Your act is like amateur hour.
And I'm not like everybody else.
I really like what you did out there.
I'm not a comedian. I don't want to go for cheap laughs.
You jerk!
What's wrong with this guy?
They detest you.
That means we're a success.
40 million people are watching you every week.
Party time for latka.
Some of us at Saturday Night Live think Andy Kaufman's a comic genius.
Thank you very much.
You just don't respect anything.
You said some pretty inflammatory things.
I'm sorry.
I've always got to be one step ahead of them.
This guy is so obnoxious.
It's good old-fashioned entertainment, George.
Is Andy Kaufman crazy?
I'm just acting crazy.
I'm going to do it again and again and again and again and again and again and again.
I'm a bad person.
You are a complicated person.
You don't know the real me.
There isn't a real you.
Oh, yeah. I forgot.
From Milos Forman, Academy Award-winning director of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus.
You're insane!
But you might also be brilliant.
Comes the story of the man, the myth, the misunderstanding.
So you just pretend to be an ass.
That's what I'm good at.
This Christmas, Jim Carrey brings the legend to life.
I would like to take this entire audience out for milk and cookies. Follow me!
Man on the Moon is a 1999 biography of the American, possibly not stand-up as such, but American entertainer, Andy Kaufman, which stars Jim Carrey as Kaufman, and co-stars Danny DeVito, who was Kaufman's co-star in real life in his sitcom Taxi. And also stars Courtney Love, okay, and Paul Giamatti.
Yeah.
Before he was Bright Lights, Paul Giamatti. So, as he's well known.
Yeah.
So, for those of you who are unaware of Andy Kaufman, which would be true of myself insofar that his fame was very much before my time, insofar as he died in, well, 1984, so literally the year before I was born. Kaufman was a performer who very much enjoyed the surreal, the kind of what is entertaining but not in a conventional humour kind of way. It's something that's been, I suppose, labelled as anti-humour. And as such, he found it initially quite difficult, you know, to work as, you know, an entertainer. However, because one of his ideas does catch fire, he gets involved with a talent agent called George Shapiro, as played by DeVito, who signs him and decides to shape his act into getting the role on the sitcom Taxi. And whilst Kaufman was not particularly happy about that, he recognised the potential that the exposure could get him to go into more elaborate stunts that he was more kind of interested in doing. And that takes him from kind of disrupting various network TV shows to getting involved in professional wrestling in Memphis.
So, yes.
And then there is more than a couple of hints that suggests that he might have even faked his own death, because that is something that remains a popular conspiracy theory to this day. But so there we are, that's Man on the Moon. Now, I was culturally aware of it, but it's just one of those films I never got round to see. So it was a first-time viewing. It was quite refreshing, you know, seeing an old-school Jim Carrey film that I hadn't ever seen before.
Right.
At this stage of both my life and, I suppose, his life, what with his new face. But, brother, when was the first time you saw Man on the Moon?
I don't know. I did watch it a long time ago. Over 10 years, I'd say easily, more like 15 or maybe even 20, who knows? But it's a film that I remember back in Leicester in the noughties and early 90s. Again, it would be the late 90s. We were all big fans of Jim Carrey because he was funny man, ha 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 ha. So we're all like looking forward to the next Jim Carrey film. And I remember seeing the very striking movie poster, which had "Hello, my name is Andy and this is my poster," and there's Jim Carrey. And I remember thinking, oh wow, what's that going to be? And obviously didn't then see it at the cinema because I would have A, been too young, and B, probably someone would have explained to me that it wasn't a wacky comedy featuring the rubber-faced man.
Yeah.
But I subsequently watched it, possibly on, say, Channel 4 or on iPlayer at some point. And really enjoyed it just because it was Jim Carrey playing a funny guy and the funny things that happened and a very interesting life and telling it in an interesting way that did lean into the whole idea of can you believe what's going on? To what extent is he fucking around? And it also, this having no understanding of who Andy Kaufman was, it was very exciting to me at the time to see, oh my God, that's Jerry the King Lawler and JR from WWE, which I would have been watching at the time. So it had all sorts of fun things in there to kind of keep me watching in what I can only imagine when I first watched it, I had no idea it was going to have. And I've watched it a couple of times since, and then watched it again for this episode here. You've already said you didn't know too much about Andy Kaufman. I was in exactly the same boat in terms of who he was as a person and the complexities behind his comedy. I had really this only as my source of truth.
Sure.
On Andy Kaufman. And it's been interesting to look at the various reviews of it, the takes on it, to kind of talk about how faithful it is to the career of Andy Kaufman and the life of Andy Kaufman, but also the drawbacks and the things that it gets wrong. In some people's eyes, surely. So I'm really interested to hear what you think about it, but I really enjoy this film kind of complete face value because I think it does a good job of explaining who he was and where he comes from for the most part, and certainly for the casual onlooker.
Mm.
It does kind of stand on its own merit, and there are enough kind of narrative loopholes that they add in where they say, yeah, we've rearranged some of the events that happens just for entertainment purposes to tell a good story. And, you know, don't think too much about that. Just enjoy yourself. That goes for you all, too. With a direct piece to camera from Jim Carrey as Kaufman. So I'll set my stall out there. What did you think upon your first watching of Man on the Moon?
I suppose because we've been covering a lot of biopics over the past, certainly few episodes.
Yeah.
It was interesting that, oh, hang on, we're doing another one. But because, because it's not necessarily to do with a musician, it was a slight shift, in what we'd been going with. It's almost a very well-timed film to review because it's tied in a lot of the biopics that we've looked at. We also looked at King of Comedy relatively recently.
Yes.
And there's another kind of idea about how does a person who considers himself an entertainer break through and what do they do for their quote-unquote art. And so I think one of the things that really helped the film, in my view, I would say I enjoyed it a fair bit. I do like the fact that it deliberately avoided your more formulaic biopic kind of structure.
Mm.
Because I think it consciously wasn't trying to tell a standard biopic on the basis that the facts around Kaufman's life were deliberately very obscure. There's a line between Kaufman and his girlfriend, as played by Courtney Love, Lynn is her name. Lynn! Mm. That's how I remember it.
Lynn!
It goes along the lines of, you're the only person to know the true me, and she says, there is no true you. Oh yeah, that's right. and in a way, because they did a similar thing, there's been a biopic of Peter Sellers in the past, which starred Jeffrey Rush as Sellers. And again, that goes on with the fact that as an entertainer, he was absolutely brilliant. But as a man, he was a complete vacuum in terms of empathy or morality or anything like that. So it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult doing biopics full stop, but this one knew that it would be difficult to get the definitive take on Andy Kaufman. Therefore, you know, play with the formula. And I think the approach that they went with, and I think, which is why I think the film works, is they went with a film that Andy Kaufman, if he was still alive and had indeed faked his death, would be pretty okay with, pretty happy with. Like, rather than just spending large tranches of it looking at his family life growing up. I mean, it's interesting.
Good use of the word trunch, by the way.
Thank you. It's interesting that his parents are there throughout, as well as his siblings, but they're not really, there's no emphasis, there's no "the wrong child died" kind of thing going throughout. They're just like, they're there, and they help weave the part of the story that is, he's a bit of a boy who cried wolf, isn't he? That Andy.
Yeah.
Which,
old Andy boy.
Yeah. But no, I enjoyed it. But I think it's, what makes it better is it's so interesting that there is a lot to actually talk about with regard to the film. Even though his career was relatively short-lived. So, with that in mind, should we start with Kerry?
What a good idea, because it's his film, and we will get on to our featured actor, Danny DeVito, at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating performance, for a number of reasons. I think he does pretty well of inhabiting most of the mannerisms of Kaufman, as far as I've seen from kind of subsequently watching some of his and again, I think you're right to say he's not a stand-up comedian. He did do stuff on stage, but it was more performance comedy and just funny bits. And yeah, he does well to kind of capture the sort of, I want to say vacuousness, but that's completely wrong. The kind of phase, the wide-eyed look at the world, the eccentricities of the man, he does well to inhabit. How are you aware of the Netflix documentary following this film quite a few years later on called Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond?
I am aware of it, and I was aware of the issues that the documentary covered before that, even having not actually seen the film, because you made mention of Jerry Lawler.
Yes.
So I, to this day, remain a wrestling fan, and I've actually met Jerry Lawler. He was at C2E2 when I was in Chicago, and he was like the first person I got an autograph off of. So there is a picture of me and Jerry Lawler.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, Jerry Lawler isn't actually a good man, so we won't go into it too much. But what I will say is that Lawler was back in the territory days. He was pretty much the biggest cheese there was in Memphis wrestling, which is where Kaufman's foray into wrestling happened. And because famously, wrestling is predetermined. Now, they kept that a lot more closely guarded a secret in the 20th century up until about the 90s, when everyone kind of, yeah, there's such a thing called kayfabe. And it is decided who wins and who loses and everything like that. But the relationship between Lawler and Kaufman was a very closely guarded secret. And it shows in this film that they got on really very well. behind the scenes. So, coming back to what you're talking about with regards to the documentary, there are several interviews of Lawler being on the record about how difficult it was working with Jim Carrey, because, you know, Lawler actually knew Kaufman for real and knew exactly how he approached things and was therefore watching a Hollywood actor not just pretend to be his friend, but pretend it in a completely different way that is being set up to be definitive to an extent. And I understand it's not just Lawler. So I don't know if Lawler specifically is very prominent within the documentary, but I know for a fact that it was Carey doing method acting throughout the production of the film, basically rubbed almost everybody up the wrong way, which is what made it a relatively difficult film to make, is my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, you pretty much hit the nail on the head. He kind of claims to have been inhabited by the spirit of Andy Kaufman and kind of just lending his body to Andy to be mischievous and performative. And I think he doesn't kind of say, I was inhabited. It was more a case of, it was as if I was. But it's certainly... It's interesting watching the film again, having watched that documentary, to kind of go, oh God, these poor people. It must have been terrible to work on this film. and I guess it would echo a lot of the frustrations, but it doesn't fall to pieces though. As he's able to be professional enough to wrangle his performance to be the right kind of Andy Kaufman for the right moment. That the script is potentially, it kind of lets Kaufman down in some ways, because it seems to imply that he was kind of hanging out, entertaining his younger sister in the bedroom, and then at some point he carries on, and then somebody just realizes, yes, you've got something here. Well, actually, he worked really hard at his act and kind of noticed at some point that, yeah, it could be fun to just treat adults like kids on stage and whatever, rather than it's kind of a cut to him on stage as an eccentric, but no one understands me kind of comedian. So it kind of does the actual Andy Kaufman a bit of a disservice. But in terms of the Andy Kaufman in the film and the version they're trying to play, he does a very good job. I would just like to go back briefly to what you were talking about, link to the making of the film with Jim Carrey. Do you remember when we went to Universal Studios, brother?
I do, yes.
And we were on the set tour, or whatever it's called. And I remember distinctly the guide talking about how recently, and I have no idea how recent it would have been, an actual Jim Carrey came out dressed as Norman Bates' mother and ran past the tour bus with a knife because of his work on the film Man on the Moon. And that was another thing that kind of painted the film as like a, oh, that was really close by to our visits kind of thing.
It was, I mean, so Man on the Moon came out 1999, 2000, so it would have been made in 1999. So that would be 4 years before we visited.
Oh yeah, 2004, wasn't it? Yeah,
2003.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't as recent, but the fact that they kind of name checked and a tour bus just like the one you're on right now was ran after by Jim Carrey. In fact, actually, I think they were filming Cat in the Hat whilst we were there.
There was a lot of Cat in the Hat material going around.
I think some kind of Susie in Town.
They'd also, I think parts of the tour involved a bit of a show regarding Hulk, which had come out a few months earlier, and about how a laboratory set was being smashed up, what with the vibrations of the Hulk. That is what I can recall.
Oh, what fun. And everyone remembers that film.
Eric Bana
being the only Hulk there's ever been.
Anyway,
that's by the by. Yeah. What do you think of him, like, looking at this with objective eyes? Did you kind of get the semblance of Andy Kaufman?
Put it this way, I trusted Jim Carrey to give it his all, and that is absolutely what he did, because you know, if you think about some of the other names that were in the frame to play it, you'd be thinking, no. Nicolas Cage. Oh, okay. I suppose Cage could have done it. But,
It would be very interesting, but I don't think it would have been.
But, like, Kaufman. John Cusack? Edward right. Norton? Kevin Spacey?
Oh, dear.
Exactly. It just wouldn't have worked. So, you do need someone who has the understanding, first of all, of somewhat unique entertaining. I think Carey is basically a guy who could definitely, he can understand why a studio would go with him to portray Kaufman. Now, you know, to whatever extent he actually nailed the impression, you know, that's for individual taste, I suppose. But, what I did find interesting, and this kind of not only helps the, going to what I was talking about with regard to Jerry Lawler, but also kind of neatly maneuvers the conversation into our featured subject of Mr. DeVito. What's very interesting about, I suppose, the whole story about Kaufman is the fact that somehow he was able to market his energy into something that brought him fame and indeed fortune, despite the fact that there was seemingly no audience for it, which is why he's got this talent agent who sees his one thing that really does catch fire, and signs him, and all of a sudden, sitcom. But what is interesting is the real George Shapiro is featured as the guy saying, "Don't come back here to this bar. I just don't see what you've got."
Yeah.
So that was who Danny DeVito was playing in the film. Despite the fact that Danny DeVito himself was Kaufman's castmate in the sitcom Taxi.
Indeed.
So what is interesting is DeVito is one of the few people from Taxi, because lots of the regular cast from Taxi actually show up to play younger versions of themselves. Just for like montages and things like that.
I found that really weird. Like, there's Christopher Lloyd, and they're just not making anything of it.
Yeah. Christopher Lloyd, Carol Kane, Judd Hirsch.
Judd Hirsch.
I mean, Taxi wasn't a sitcom that was on when we were growing up.
No.
Have you seen any of it?
No.
Okay.
not at all.
I've seen the odd clip here or there. It is. We'll talk about it more with its importance to DeVito's career later on, but it was, you know, a genuine cultural recognised sitcom, did wonders for certain people's careers, Kaufman obviously, DeVito, but it's through that DeVito just plays Shapiro throughout, so his is a completely straight role. He's not playing anything for laughs. He's there to try and rein in both Kaufman and his writing partner, Bob Zmuda, as played by Paul Giamatti, is the only other person who's kind of in on the joke of Tony Clifton.
Indeed.
Who was
very funny.
Andy Kaufman's alter ego character, who is not very obvious to the extent that it is implied that Zmuda plays him when it comes to the part of the joke where everyone has to think that Kaufman is so obviously Zmuda that they couldn't appear together at the same time. And yet they do. So,
indeed.
Yeah, it's a very odd one. What do you think about DeVito?
I when we picked this film to cover for DeVito Month, I was a little bit worried as to like how much is he actually in this film? And actually, I was quite surprised and quite pleased that he was in it a lot more than I remembered. And he is the guy who has to put up with his bullshit and try and keep him marketable all the way through. To the point where he's... We usually do a comedic actor in the first episode of the year proper.
Yeah.
And I think most people would say that Danny DeVito is largely a comedy actor, yes, or appears in comedic stuff. However, I don't think or can't think of too many out-and-out comedic films off the top of my head that he's in, and this is certainly not one of them. As in, like, okay, it's a comedic film, but it's not a comedic role within this film. It's him being, as you say, the complete straight man,
yeah,
and having to be someone who's a little bit kind of ticked off, but affable enough to kind of sort of understand and eventually kind of get the humour, or if not completely get it, then get it enough to market it. And to that end, he does a very good job. I like the moustache he's got. really important.
Excellent criticism. Here on Hey An Actor.
I'm just saying, prosthetic hair on the face. He's got a nice moustache. Anyway. And he's there all the way through. And because he's not just the manager, he has to have more of a personal relationship with Andy. He is one of the few people who's there towards the end of the film when Kaufman tells people in his life that he's got cancer.
Yeah.
And you see this. One credit of the film for me is the whole, oh, God, really? But in a kind of understanding way kind of thing. And you can see, based on what's happened in the film so far, that, yeah, this could very well be one of his wacky things that he does out of complete bad taste. Because previously in the film, they've played around with this TV special, making it look like the TV set's out of wax. So everyone would have to stand up and said, the set is amazing, it's hilarious. And this is the nth degree of that. Where it looks like it could be complete bad taste bullshittery, and he's kind of cross enough. He seems earnest, does Kaufman, so he's there not dismissing it, but he's like, I swear to God, Zamuda, you asshole! in full DeVito guise. I think one drawback is you never look at him and think, that's not Danny DeVito. He has quite a... Because this is meant to be based on real people and it is real people, you are looking a little bit beyond the people. And because there are so many real people within the film as well, from Kaufman's life, there's the real Jerry Lawler, there's the real cast of Taxi. And where is Danny DeVito? Why is he not? Oh, well, it's because he's doing that. So there is a little bit of an uncomfortable thing, or it might be worth as part of the just a little bit of a wink and a nod to the audience to reference it, because otherwise, if you do know a lot about Taxi, and I assume a lot of the fans of this film would have been, you know, that is a bit of an area of discord. So he does a good job. I just think the way the film is made, it makes you just a little bit, you can't fully engage with his character in a full believable style. Does that sound fair?
I think so. With regard to the making of the film, then, how much do you know about the director, Miloš Forman?
I looked into him. Yeah. I know he was not by any means the first choice, but I've forgotten everything that I read.
Miloš Forman was actually a very highly acclaimed director. This is not something that you'd necessarily associate with him. Two films right off the bat that I'd give you that you'll have heard of, if not seen. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, okay, with former Haas subject Guy Mann.
No.
What's he called?
Jack Nicholson has not been a hard subject thus far.
Has he not?
No.
Oh, no, we just did Chinatown.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stayed anyway. One to think of.
And Bucket List. Oh, yep. How interesting. Okay, fine.
Although, who was in that? Danny DeVito.
In what?
Danny DeVito was also in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yep.
He was in Chinatown.
More famously, Amadeus in 1984.
Oh yeah,
and his adaptation,
Rock Me film,
his adaptation of Amadeus basically won all of the Oscars,
every single
that
one
year. He also did a film called The People versus Larry Flint, in which Woody Harrelson plays a pornographer. And it might actually explain the casting of Courtney Love, because she was cast as Larry Flint's wife. So,
well, I'll be.
Who would have thought the kind of spiritual muse of a highly acclaimed Czech American director would be Courtney Love, the woman who killed grunge?
Hey now, stop that!
By hole. I'm not making any allegations. I don't have.
What do you mean? I have a lot of time for Hole. Okay. When I'm in my erstwhile bands, the two songs that we played very, very, very much. One was "Fly Away" by Lenny Kravitz.
Sure.
And one was "Celebrity Skin" by Hole.
Nice.
And both were played at Johnny's wedding recently. It was a lot of fun to mime power chords.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. My ex was quite big into Courtney Love, so that.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Puts me off. That's
fair enough.
It's just one of those things. Even now. Yeah, but I mean, aside from Courtney Love, she's there for the second half of the film.
And I think she does a perfectly good job. I've not seen her in many films.
Well, that's because she's not really an actress. But But there she is, yeah. But it's not a role that's particularly demanding either. It's really, you're looking for someone who's believable as someone who would attend wrestling, you know, just as a hobby and things like that, and is willing to put up with Kaufman's kind of nervy energy.
Right.
And, you know, she gives some of it back with regards to the fact that he basically tricked her into marriage or something like that by involving her in the wrestling. But in terms of supporting cast, I mean, there's a good call to say that Jerry Lawler playing himself is a supporting character.
Well, there's loads.
There's loads of faces, but they're not really. It would be a struggle to call them a supporting cast, is probably what I'm going for.
Well, I guess not. I mean, the main central four are the ones we've talked about already.
Yeah.
Paul Giamatti we've not touched on too much, but he's funny in a kind of a sort of good comedic giggle man to.
He's a kind of comedy enabler.
Yeah, the kind of comedy Dave as of the.
For our American listeners, Dave McVitie.
Not McVitie, that's a biscuit manufacturer.
That's true.
Vitie.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I think he does a podcast on motoring now. I've heard him do adverts on Spotify.
The supporting cast, largely because, I mean, his family are in it a bit, but not massively. And they kind of age up with Kaufman, and they're there at his funeral. The dad's there at the beginning and the end of the film, as is the mum, saying, you know, he's a very odd boy, our Andy. He should be outside playing sports. But then the supporting cast is largely a kind of weird a weird list of actual people from his life, including the taxi people. There's Norm MacDonald. Appears because he was in an episode of Saturday Night Live. No, not Saturday Night Live. A sort of
Fridays.
Similar thing. Fridays.
Yeah, but Norm MacDonald is actually playing Michael Richards, who went on to become Kramer in Seinfeld.
Oh, well, I'll be. Fine.
Because Norm MacDonald was actually on SNL in his own right.
Right.
Yeah.
But decided, let's switch it up. One of the weird criticisms of the film comes in the form of another cameo done by Lorne Michaels, who is big in the live American comedy scene, mainly Saturday Night Live, but also Kids in the Hall and 30 Rock. He's kind of a sort of knowable person, and I assume people who know Andy Kaufman would know him very well. But he plays... He does... he plays himself, but he doesn't. So when there's that scene where he puts the vote to the audience, do we want to keep him or chuck him from Saturday Night Live? Mm. That wasn't actual Lorne Michaels. I don't think he was actually in charge of the show at the
time.
No,
he wasn't.
It was somebody else. But he's there playing it. And actually, it's a bit of a misnomer because the actual vote was meant to have been in collaboration with Andy Kaufman. As another kind of here's a hilarious gag type thing.
Sure.
And people voted no, but then the guy who actually did it screwed him over because the whole point was meant to be he's banned from SNL because people have voted no, but then he would keep coming back on SNL as sort of a bad guy character or how did you get on it this time? You're meant to be banned or I'll get you. Andy Kaufman. But actually he was screwed over and then he wasn't allowed back on SNL.
Right.
So the film makes you look like it's part of his downfall where people just don't get his comedy anymore. And there's a lot to be said for that. But the whole moment is played completely wrong on purpose. And then in the next clip, there's Andy Kaufman or Jim Carrey kind of going, oh, God, this is bad. They don't get me. He liked being bad. He liked being bad guy wrestler and confusing people. Why is he concerned now? They play a bit fast and loose with the motivations of Andy Kaufman. And that's, I mean, I didn't catch it first time round, but the more you think about it, it's like, well, is this on purpose they're doing this to try and make you wonder about was this actually what he was thinking? Oh no! Or is this another kind of nod to the audience in terms of, well, we'll never tell kind of thing? And I don't like the way they do it. I think there's a lot to be said for unreliable narrator and its place within films like this, especially when it's a figure of such not controversy, but an interesting way of doing stuff where you can never really tell what's a prank and what's not, or subverting people's reality. But then, I don't know, they play for so much heart with it, it's difficult to take it as seriously. I don't know. It doesn't hurt the film entirely for me, but kind of a failing.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, you just play around with bits and pieces here and there, but again, I think if you approach it as more of a kind of tapestry as to what he got up to, whether or not you think the through line is satisfying, it's probably down to personal taste. I kind of really got the whole trip to the Philippines bit, because as dark as it was, it's just like, the fact that there is some kind of appreciation at the end of it as to various different types of fraud, I think is a kind of nice ring to how all that plays out. And that is very much mirrored in the final scene where you think, oh, there he is, there's Tony Clifton. So it's Bob Zemuda just, you know, paying tribute and everyone's laughing away, and then, oh look, there's Bob Zemuda in the audience laughing at
him. What? Yeah. Does that mean he's alive?
There we go.
Yeah. So it tries to have its cake and eat it too in terms of the what's real and what's not real. And for the most part, it gets away with it. And it's enabled by, I guess, the incredulity of Danny DeVito's character to be the kind of guy that, hey, look, he's a wild, eccentric guy. Whoa. And then, oh God, you absolute wanker, what are you doing? You know, you need to have somebody to play the straight man, but ultimately caring, in order to pull that off. And Jim Carrey does a really good performance. Courtney Love does very well. It's a good film. I enjoy it every time I watch it.
Now, one thing that was interesting about this is a quote-unquote Jim Carrey film. This is the first of his major films to bomb.
Oh, did it bomb?
Yes. It was made somewhere between $52 and $82 million, but only pulled in $47.
Somewhere between?
Yes.
That's a big span. That's $30 million somewhere between
one way or another. Pandy, it lost money. Shut up!
It's just to the tune of $5 or $35 million
plus marketing. But this is so. This is coming off. So after his initial run of films that broke him out, obviously The Cable Guy wasn't well received, but it wasn't a bomb. So the films that were kind of leading up to Man on the Moon, you had Liar Liar, which is, you know, him in what you'd expect his main modes to be. And then the year before, again, he'd been working with a visionary director in Peter Weir in making The Truman Show, which...
Was that a bomb?
Obviously, Jim Carrey, for those of us who haven't been with us since the beginning, was our very first featured actor.
Yeah.
And whilst
did we cover The Truman Show?
No, we covered Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah.
We covered your favourite film, I Love You, Philip Morris.
Indeed.
And
Peter's Cloud in the Sky.
And Ace Ventura.
Fair.
Yeah, no, but the Truman Show is legitimately one of my favourite films of all time.
That's a great film.
Absolutely great film. So I can understand why he was thinking that this would be... probably a similar kind of thing, like, again, making him seem like a more legit actor, but perhaps because it's about a comedian stroke entertainer, therefore, you know, it would be more in his wheelhouse. But I don't know if it's because Andy Kaufman was perhaps just not, you know, the big kind of comedic figure that would attract people, or... perhaps it would be the suggestion of a bit of melancholy. We should say that R.E.M. did the soundtrack for this film.
Oh, yeah. You want melancholy in your film. Talk to R.E.M.
Yeah.
Do they not... this is another film where starring Jim Carrey scored by R.E.M. or with a title track by R.E.M. I'm sure there's another one.
So they did, for this... film, they did
Man on the Moon.
Man on the Moon and The Great Beyond.
Was that for the same...
It was for the same film.
Right, fair enough.
I'm breaking through, I'm bending spoons, I'm putting flowers in full bloom, I'm looking for answers to The Great Beyond.
Oh, answers from the great... answer...
which explains the documentary title.
I'm breaking through, I'm bending spoons, I'm keeping flowers in full bloom.
That's
what I'm looking for, answers from the great, answers from the great, answers!
Lovely stuff.
Sorry.
So it wasn't a financial success, and the critical response was mixed. It was around 64% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh,
and as it's a new year, let's leave it there. I am very glad that I've seen Man of the Moon. It's one of those blind spots that I've been meaning to address. And
sure.
I think it's a very good film outing for Carey. I think DeVito's really very good in it. I probably said at some point he was also the producer, so he had an interest in how the project was guided and envisioned.
Indeed.
So, I'd watch it again, certainly.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. What fun.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's pop in a trailer for our next featured film then. And just like the 3-time Oscar-winning star of films like Poor Thing, Spider-Man or The Amazing Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man 2, let's do what Andrew Garfield did at some point and go romancing the stone.
I'm getting out of this jungle dump. I'm fed up to here with this treasure hunt business. Yeah. Ira, you miserable worm, you lied to me. You said she was a city girl, out of her element. Just get her in the map and bring him back. Piece of cake, my butt. What went wrong? I'll tell you what went wrong. First of all, guess who else is here? You're dead right, Solo.
What?
Secondly, she's got herself a partner. You like shooting holes in everything.
The minimum price for taking a stranded woman to a telephone
is $400.
$375 in traveler's checks?
Not a deal.
That's just the beginning of what's going on down here. There's nothing you can say that'll make you go back into that hellhole. Don't bring that up, Ira. Ira, stop it! All right, I'll go back. But this time,
you're coming with me.
Romancing the Stone is a 1984 comedy-adventure romance film starring Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner and Danny DeVito as a writer gets embroiled with a horrible kidnapping slash ransom plot. So she has to travel to far off Colombia to follow some instructions, but because she's a little bit hapless, is Joan Wilder, the romance writer, she goes in the wrong direction. Hilarious consequences of derping around leads her into the arms of young romantic lead Michael Douglas, and they go on a wonderful trek across the country, meeting a variety of colourful characters and some kind of treasure hunting thing as well. It's a film I'd never seen before. Brother, when was the first time you watched Romancing the Stone?
I caught this one in my teens.
Okay.
It was one that I was idly going through the Radio Times back in the lesser days, and it was just like, hey, I like Danny DeVito, and this sounds like a bit of an interesting film to come across, especially because I read up it had a sequel, and then a kind of quasi-tertiary film, which we'll touch upon later. So I decided, rightio, I'll give it a go. Very much enjoyed it at the time, but never really thought about it that much again, to the extent that I didn't actually bother going out to see the sequel. I mean, going out to see, as in look up the sequel, obviously. Sure. They happened in the 80s. But, yeah, because I kind of wanted to fill a bit of a hole, because obviously I knew who Danny DeVito was. Michael Douglas, I was aware of. Kathleen Turner, I was aware of, but I hadn't really seen their films as such. So I was like, haha, two birds, one stone. And gave it a go and very much enjoyed it, but not to the extent that I raved about it wildly or anything. So, I very much enjoyed it at the time. And then coming back to it, I was similarly charmed. Notwithstanding, I've seen a lot more films since then, and I think you could obviously make comparisons between it and a few other kind of adventure films. I'll obviously get your thoughts on that in a moment. But just on your first time viewing of the film, brother, what were you thinking about Romancing the Stone?
Well, you kind of already know, brother, because we watched it together over Christmas.
We did.
And you know, we had a very nice evening watching Romancing the Stone, and I found it very funny. I didn't expect it to be as comedic as it was. I knew, so out of the three main cast, I probably knew DeVito the best. Then, yeah, probably Michael Douglas. Kathleen Turner, I've not seen in very many things at all, as it turns out.
Interesting.
Mainly as Chandler's dad from Friends, which is completely unfair. I know she was the voice of Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah, that's
from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But this is probably the first out-and-out acting role I can certainly remember seeing her be in it. And she's brilliant. And she really helps you to kind of... The film doesn't work without her. And it's a comedy of errors in many ways, and there's all sorts of stupid things that happen, and like, it's almost like an episode of a sequel or from the same universe as Carry On Spying. As in, like, she gets to the place okay. and accidentally gets on the wrong bus because somebody's looking the wrong way. And there's just all sorts of stupid little foibles that derps her into the path of Michael Douglas. They shouldn't have met. This shouldn't have been a thing. But it just so happens that, you know, he's exactly who she needs to meet at this time. And hody, hody, ho.
Yeah.
I was a bit concerned going into it that we didn't see too much of Danny DeVito, certainly from the outset. But he's...
I mean, he is short.
Hey now. He's short in stature. What a silhouette. He's an interesting presence in the film because he's one of the main drivers for her being out there, albeit he's the kind of henchman to one of the big bads, among a few different big bads, to be fair. But he's the more comedic big bad, or henchman, who sort of is at odds with the guy he works for because, you know, he's a bit of a twat and, oh, God, I can't believe you got me into this mess. And therefore he's out at the coalface going into police stations and go, oh, shit, don't look at my wanted poster. Oh, no. So, yeah, I really enjoyed watching it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think there's a lot of things that don't work. If you think about it logically, okay. But it's an 80s comedy, you know, who cares?
Yeah. That's the thing, because when you think about 80s comedies, you think about all of the kind of comedians who came up through the fourth, through television. Mm. So you kind of think about the comedians who dominated Saturday Night Live or SCTV, who then spent most of the 80s in comedic films. Mm. So obviously you've got people like Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, Rick Moranis, Chevy Chase, people of that ilk. Whereas this is more, you know, film stars. And Danny DeVito, I mean, Danny DeVito was coming off a sitcom.
Yeah, he had finished Taxi the year before, or it had finished the year before.
Yes.
So he would have been fairly well known for that and starting to head out onto his own, forging his own path after that. And, you know, if this is an early role for him, and it's possibly one of the main reasons we chose it. This episode.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a really good first film for him because he's not got a huge amount of kind of weight on his shoulders, but the film would be a lot lesser without him. He's fun throughout. You can see him be the same kind of hard-nosed, and I don't know whether his character in Taxi was a bit of a crim or not, but you know, he's certainly a bit of a dubious, dodgy character, but you can certainly find him funny and not. Like, what was the film we covered recently where I didn't like any of them because they were criminals? Oh, yeah, Goodfellas.
All right.
Obviously, this is not Goodfellas. Okay, think about it in terms of Chicago. I could, like, see him as a criminal doing horrible things, somebody, kind of hostage situation, ransom notes, blah, blah, blah.
It should be noted. So, he is an antiquities smuggler.
Okay.
And he and his cousin Ira are getting involved with a kidnapping hostage scheme. There's a degree of reluctance on one of the cousins' part with regards to it, but it just so happens that DeVito's character Ralph gets involved in more of the comedy hijinks.
Including crawling underneath tables, falling down hills, all sorts of falling and being on the floor, which is funny when funny man fall down.
I think it's fair to say that, I mean, if you're going straight from a sitcom to a movie, especially if you're best known for comedy, you're either going to be the star or you're going to be the main kind of sidekick comedy relief as such. And I think it suits DeVito very much to find his niche in the latter. Because you wouldn't necessarily put a film on his shoulders automatically if he was just coming out of Taxi. Because he wasn't exactly the star of Taxi. Mm. I mean, so his role was being the kind of dispatcher, so sending taxi drivers to, you know, this route and that route and what have you. So he wasn't like a villain or anything, but he was the kind of
hard-nosed kind of boss guy kind of running the operation. So here, you know, it's a Colombian setting. What's the fish out of water story? Danny DeVito.
Hooray!
in Colombia. Now, not to say that the other white leads aren't out of place, but it's kind of the point that Kathleen Turner's Joan is out of place and needing guidance, and that comes in the form of Michael Douglas's Jack T. Colton character.
I mean, Jack T. Colton, if there could be a more American name, I'm not sure I could think of it off the top of my head.
It's right up
like
there, isn't it?
Clyde Eagle. Or Chad football quarterback.
Sure. That's the one.
He's just a small town boy dreaming big. He's going to marry his high school sweetheart, who's also the sophomore prom queen 5 years running.
What I would say is the interesting thing is, yes, you did announce Douglas first, and he is technically first billed, and he also produced the film, but he wasn't going to be the star of the film, because really the protagonist is Kathleen Turner's character, and that put off a lot of actors from taking on the Colton role in the first place.
Well, because it was going to be a female lead of a film.
Because technically the female lead was the star.
Well, what a bunch of twats.
Absolutely. Well, no, that's very much the mindset.
Yeah.
In a way, it kind of self-selects the casting for you.
Yeah, I guess so.
We've had examples of that in the past.
Oh, remind me.
I want to say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but for example, I think it was Bedknobs and Broomsticks. They couldn't secure the services of the guy who famously played Fagin, Ron Moody, that's the
okay.
name. I think they couldn't get him to be Emilius Potts because the film wasn't about Emilius Potts.
What an absolute twat.
Now, I could very much be getting that wrong, but it's that kind of story
right. That
absolutely kind of put certain actors off of certain projects. Ugh. Now, the thing is, Douglas is one of the, not original, but he is one of Hollywood's big nepo babies insofar as his dad is Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
And that's a bit because Douglas also had a hand in the production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
right.
Which we mentioned earlier and will be mentioning again. And one of the reasons he was involved is because his dad really wanted to play the title role.
Oh.
But he was just too old. And so, young Michael did, I don't know if it was him specifically who stood up to him, but basically it was made clear to Kirk Douglas, no, you can't star in this film.
You can't do it.
You're too old. And then it went to Jack Nicholson. It does help that Jack Nicholson, Michael Douglas, Danny DeVito, they all kind of grew up together.
Yeah, so, that's nice. I remember we did a bit of maths whilst we were watching the film, that he was 40 years old at this point, and he's carrying himself as in the vein of a much younger man. He's a kind of world-weary, I don't know, how would you describe it? He's very independent. He's just kind of a big American dude who's making a living kind of under the cosh in Colombia just cause selling birds.
Put it this way. I mean, so he's a bird smuggler, but he's actively chosen to live out in Colombia and stands out like a sore thumb, but that only kind of increases his kind of hero charisma. I mean, I think a film you could compare this film to relatively positively. I mean, I prefer what I'm about to say, but
And there are obvious differences, but in terms of like adventure films, I kept thinking about The
Mummy. I was going to say The Mummy, a similar kind of big, suave American bloke who just happens to be in an international country and doesn't really ingratiate himself, but knows the score.
He's got the action chops to help shield the non-action characters away from the danger. And as such, that makes him irresistible to the female lead.
And the female lead is also heavily involved with books. I am a librarian. I am a romance novelist. And there's also a wacky comic relief character, Jonathan and Ruff. Oh my god! Romancing the mummy. They are coming back to do another mummy film, do you know?
They are.
With the original Evie's coming back.
Yes, yes, Rachel
Hooray,
Weisz.
Hurrah.
Rachel Weisz, every morning you greet
Daniel
me,
Craig.
Says Daniel Craig. Yes. No, looking forward to that. But with regard to this film specifically, it's an interesting role for Michael Douglas, because, again, he's kind of the right age to be able to suit the environment well, but he's not so old that, you know, it's a case of the relationship doesn't seem believable. I mean, Kathleen Turner is not necessarily, you know, absurdly young. I think we worked out she was 30 at the time. So, I mean, there's a 10-year age gap.
Yeah, they play each other well. It seems like a couple that were always going to get together. It's not kind of a complete Hollywood, Jesus Christ, he's way too old for her situation. That's probably more towards, her being kind of a sort of bookish young lady, who's kind of got everything in the big city but needs more, versus Michael Douglas, who is older but playing younger. So it kind of meets somewhere in the middle.
And how she is, in and of her own right, a celebrity. She's living quite a comfortable life in New York. Slightly unfulfilled in that she's I believe the vice president referred to as a childless cat lady.
J.D. Vance's favourite.
That could all change, what with her sister being kidnapped in Colombia.
Oh no! What a shame.
Don't you just hate it when that happens?
Oh, God, the amount of times I could count on no hands.
Yeah, always bailing Claire out of Colombia, honestly.
Well, if she will go relic
hunting. Her husband. Exactly. Anyway, it's a nice setup. And then the locale of Colombia, specifically, is not one that I've really come across a lot.
Well, I certainly don't know enough about it to say it's clearly not Colombia. It seems like kind of your stereotypical South American country for the uninitiated. And, you know, they've got kind of parties in the town square where everyone's dancing and everyone knows exactly what the mood is. And two white people go to the middle of the floor and everyone claps them because they're the best dancers. Wow, you must fall in love. So there's a lot of kind of what we might now say is kind of stereotypical beats. Maybe they were more revolutionary at the time. I don't know. But, I think there's a kind of weird charm to this film. You used the word charm earlier, and I agree with that. Mm. That you've got people who play off really well together. You can buy the relationship between Douglas and Turner. You can buy into Danny DeVito being a bit of a wrong'un, but oh well. And the stakes kind of getting higher and higher as they, again, derp themselves into different situations of people wanting to get access to this thing. But then there's lots of lighthearted comedy relief moments in between, including the fact that this horrible revered warlord in a particular village is a massive fan of her romance novels. It comes out of goddamn nowhere, which is a lot of fun. And then he drives like a maniac to help them get away.
I mean, you've got that. We did point out Chekhov's crocodile pit at the beginning. Pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But there was that. And then I thought we're not going to spoil the ending, notwithstanding it's a 41-year-old film. I thought the ending was a slight surprise.
Okay.
Not so much that it ended happily, but the fact that it's just like, well, he sacrificed this so that this other thing could happen. And then he's like, oh, he didn't sacrifice at all, really. Yeah. He's just like, I will temporarily do something that looks like a sacrifice and then get back out there.
Yeah.
Because Danny needs some boots.
Yeah, basically.
But you did have a kind of relentless killer antagonist as well.
Very kind of Bond villain.
Zolo. Mm, yeah. So obviously I enjoyed
indeed,
that.
Indeed, just kept coming and coming and coming and, oh God, there he is. Ah, and then, yeah, a really good antagonist figure who is a constant threat all the way through and is still just a little bit silly enough to fit within the tone of the film, but still menacing. Yeah. And oh my God, they're going to die. But, you know, yeah, no.
And, otherwise there's not really a huge amount of, guest characters or a supporting cast that you'd know. The only person I'd really point out is Holland Taylor, who is Joan's friend slash literary agent at the beginning.
Yeah, she's Mrs. Geller from Friends. Another Friends reference.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that, but she is... the Stern professor in Legally Blonde.
Oh, yes, that's right.
She's Jim Carrey's mum in The Truman Show.
Oh, yeah.
She's also the matriarch on 2 and a Half Men.
Oh, well, I don't know much about that. Well, you don't know much about that. I might be wrong on the Friends thing then, because I don't think she'd be both.
You don't?
I don't think so. I definitely recognise her from somewhere, but it wasn't from that. But yeah, I mean, this film did very well for lots of reasons. Most notably, a massive box office return, over 10 times its budget. I mean, it looks really good. We've not really talked. I mean, we said that it's in Colombia, but there are various different parts of Colombia. There's kind of paddy, ricey fields. There is the plains. There's kind of dangerous rivers. There are towns. I mean, everywhere they go to looks unique and distinct. And they even go into some sort of like hidden temple-y cave at some point as well. And it looks great all the way through. And you know, they talk about the scenery being kind of a character. The character of Colombia is definitely a thing.
Well done to Mexico for standing in Colombia. Now, with regard to the visual flair, however, this comes to our director, who was one Robert Zemeckis.
Oh, I'm sure I've heard that name before.
We've mentioned a film of his that he's done previously.
Romancing the Stone.
For which
yes, of course. No, he framed Roger Rabbit, amongst lots
but
of
the,
other things.
The thing was, this was his third film.
Okay.
His previous two films had bombed. Therefore, this was kind of his breakout hit, which then led him on to a little project called Back to the Future.
The power of love is a curious thing.
Yep. And he never looked back.
He never needed
to. By which I meant he didn't do the sequel.
Much to its detriment.
But, you know, as you said, you alluded, I don't think you actually cited the figures specifically. The budget was $10 million. Mm-hmm. And it had a box office of $115.1 million. Which is really very good.
And because of that, it garnered a sequel.
It sure did.
Which, in a typical kind of 80s flair, was a very quick turnaround time.
It was a year later.
A year and a bit later.
1985.
Because, you know, it worked really well with Home Alone. Although, to be fair, that's more than 90s, isn't it? Anyway, it's like, we've got a good thing going, so come on, let's hit it off. Do you want to know my interesting tidbit of information about The Jewel of the Nile, the sequel?
Go for it, brother.
It raised the popularity of the song "When the Going Gets Tough, the Tough Get Going" by Billy Ocean.
I
saw Billy Ocean in Northampton a couple of years ago.
Did you?
I was drunk off my ass and don't remember much about it at all.
Was he performing, yes, or did you just bump into him by his friends?
He was next to Alan Moore in the post office.
With the lead piping. But yes, so the three actors are in a music video for said song, where they're all wearing white suits and singing along.
I'm sure it's a lot
all very nice. We can't use it for this because this is a different
thing. Yeah.
And as I said, there was also a third film in which Douglas Turner and DeVito teamed up for. Now, it's not actually featuring the same characters per se, but it was a film called The War of the Roses.
Indeed.
In which Douglas and Turner played a married couple, and they're going through a very bitter divorce battle. Mm. So DeVito, again, co-starred, but he also directed. And it's a film that was remade last year with Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman.
Deedy Doodles.
I didn't see.
Neither did I. But I heard Benedict Cumberbatch was on the Adam Buxton podcast talking about it briefly. And it sounded like... they name-checked the original film and how it's... I think the more recent version is a bit more faithful to the novel that both of them are based on. But, you know, the same thing about, like, taking things to a really, really nth degree of matrimonial dispute.
Mm.
What fun.
Well, yeah, divorce.
Lol. Yeah, joy.
Cool. Anything else about Romancing the Stone,
brother? It was a lot of fun. I mean, if we're piecing together the narrative of the career of Danny DeVito, and we've name-checked Taxi because it came up in Man in the Moon, and this film was released just after that finished. One interesting kind of start to this guy's movie career, and then it kind of rockets forwards innumerably over the next few years to the point where he is a really established person. So it's a good kind of step on the career ladder of a young Danny DeVito.
Absolutely it is. Good stuff. Well, I'm glad we could.
Absolutely. I really want to watch the second one. I can't remember what we did. I've now cancelled my Disney Plus subscription. So I'll have to, maybe next Christmas we can watch it if I bring it back so we can watch it.
Everything's on the internet.
Anyway, so...
Well then.
After you.
Well then, so let's go forward onto our feature presentation. And this is the charming adaptation, which again, Danny DeVito directs and co-stars and, like Dennis Waterman, sings the theme tune. It is Danny DeVito's version of Roald Dahl's classic, Matilda.
Once upon a time, there was a girl named Matilda.
Hi, Dad.
Get in the car, Melinda.
Matilda.
Whatever.
Who was extraordinary in every way.
Pretty soon you'll be able to do any multiplication, whether it's 2 times 7.
14.
Or 13 times 379.
4,927.
Wow. She can multiply large sums in her head.
So can a calculator.
But in a world where grown-ups make all the rules.
I'm smart, you're dumb.
I'm big and you're small.
I'm right.
And you're wrong.
In a school where the principal...
In this school, I am God!
...has no principles.
Yes, Miss Trunchbull!
Sir?
The Trunchbull used to be in the Olympics. Shot put. Javelin. Hammer throw.
She will discover...
Somebody's got to teach her a lesson.
Deep inside herself.
You should believe in whatever power you think you have inside of you.
A secret weapon.
I said it was my powers.
To even the odds.
No more Miss Nice Girl.
Hey, dipface, have a carrot.
Nah, you eat it.
Now.
Cookie.
You will not leave this platform until you have consumed the entire confection.
She gives power.
You can do it, Brucey!
To the powerless. Help to the helpless.
Harry, take your hat off.
I can't get it off.
A disaster. To those who deserve it. From the author of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach. And the unique vision.
What did you do to your hair?
Of director Danny DeVito comes the story of every kid's right to stand tall, no matter how small. Matilda.
Matilda is a 1996 fantasy comedy film, which is an adaptation of Roald Dahl's 1988 children's novel, which stars cousin Mara Wilson as the titular Matilda, and also stars Danny DeVito, Rhea Perlman, Embeth Davids, and Pam Ferris. And it is the story of, ostensibly, if you think Carrie, but just as a slightly younger girl, telekinetic powers, a bit less murder, but not no murder. And
what?
Well, the it happened off screen, obviously, but there's a very big implication.
Oh, I see.
Of murder.
Sure.
And,
but not done by Matilda.
No, not Carrie. Done by Matilda. Crucially. And, yes, it's like, what should become of her terrible parents slash brother? So, some Carrie-style revenge or not?
I mean, that could be fun to see, the sequel. Matilda 2.
The Rage.
The return of the Rage from afar.
There we go. Yes, so it is a film that I remember seeing in the cinema.
I'm pretty sure I saw it in the cinema as well. I don't remember going to see it because it was released in 1996. I would have been eight. Who knows what was going on in that noggin of mine.
I have a feeling that I saw it in the Odeon in Leicester, the old Odeon in Leicester, which has now been knocked down and remade as The Curve.
Oh, okay.
That being said, given the time of year, it was around the time that we'd moved to Teesside, so...
We may have seen it up north, we could have seen it on Hollybobs, who knows, but...
Indeed.
Yeah. Oh, well, either way, what do you remember thinking about it when you first watched it, and do you remember reading the book?
I did read the book, yes. Big Roald Dahl fan of his literature. and so, I mean, Matilda wasn't one of my favourite books.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure why. I suppose it kind of had a bit of a twits thing in there's pranks and then there's the story. And,
I guess.
Yeah, I think Matilda in and of herself wasn't that interesting. She was more of a kind of nice person cipher against the more ghoulish characters.
Okay.
But I think it's more a case that Matilda's one of the books where the ghoulish characters kind of steal the show.
I mean, there is the larger-than-life Miss Trunchbull who looms large, and of course the Wormwoods being Indeed. Horrible people. You're absolutely right. I think it'd be unfair to say that she's not got a lot to do in the book.
I didn't say that. I just found her perhaps less interesting. And perhaps I also had to suspend my disbelief that she's meant to be six throughout.
I mean, that's what makes her so incredible.
That is true. That is true. I was a very unfair boy when I read the
Girls can't do book. Things, said Ian in 1996.
Yeah, take that, Claire. but then she had the last laugh. In life. But as to watching it, I seem to recall enjoying it because I was aware at the time through movies, games and videos just who Mara Wilson was.
Right.
I think I'd seen Mrs. Doubtfire. But then it was that, and then she was also quite well known for the remake of Miracle on 34th Street.
Indeed.
With Leicester's own Sir Richard Attenborough.
Dickie.
Dicky himself. And again, Danny DeVito was known to me. So this is probably the first film of his I saw in the cinema, as a guess.
You didn't see Batman Returns in the cinema.
I was too young for Batman Returns.
Oh, fair enough.
My first Batman in the cinema was Batman Forever.
Sure.
Yes. But yeah, I seem to recall enjoying it. As to... since the mid-90s, I think this is probably my first time rewatching it since seeing it in the cinema.
Good lord, really?
Well, I think so. I've just not had any reason to rewatch it, really.
Okay.
You know, not having children. what about you? I mean, what do you remember about the first time you saw it, and how many times have you seen it since?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've definitely watched it a lot more than you, because it's
sure.
It's one of those films that schools love, because it's a pretty good film based on a book. And it does a good job of kind of cutting some things out and putting some things in and kind of being very stylized in of itself. And obviously it's something that you could put on with the kids. So I've probably watched it a handful of times over the years. The very first time watching it, I can't really remember, but I'm sure I watched it when it was relatively new. It's a film that had a big shelf life or came to life on home video. And I get the idea that we may have rented it at some point as well. Whether you then barred yourself from watching it, I don't know. But we certainly didn't own it, put it that way. In terms of the story itself, again, the connection with school is a strong one. It's also something we had as a book on CD for Evie when she was a lot younger. And had a car with a CD player in it.
Who was the narrator?
It was Kate Winslet. And actually, she was very good.
Yeah, good. Yeah. One hard subject.
Yeah, indeed. So yeah, it's a film that I kind of knew a lot about. And then the other connection to the story itself, I don't remember reading the book. I've subsequently read it to classes and obviously heard it on CD, as I just said. But it also had another life, which we can briefly touch upon, as a musical version.
Ah, yes.
Made by the illustrious musician / comedian Tim Minchin for the Royal Shakespeare Company with other people as well, which I know you have not seen. I have seen it in the theatre and Ooh. Think it's rather good. It's closer to the book and rewrites some of the things that were kind of Americanized in this version. And that's not to say that the film takes too many liberties, and it's probably something that Roald Dahl wouldn't have approved of at all, because it's a film based on his property. It's a really well done version of the book mixed in with awesome songs as well. So it's a story that I know very well, put it that way. It's probably the first time I've watched this film in a long time. I really enjoy this as a film. It's stylized to buggery. There are a lot of kind of extra things thrown into the mix that weren't really a thing in the book, like Pee-wee Herman's character.
The FBI.
The FBI.
Not just Pee-wee Herman, but Bob the Goon as well.
Of course. How could I forget? I just forgot.
Because, again, Tracy Walter, one of those people DeVito knew from back in growing up in Jersey.
Back in Joysey.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a friendly guy. So, yeah, what do you think about this film? Either or the story mixed with the film? Give me your thoughts.
Now, because it's been so long since I've read the book, I mean, I didn't necessarily think a lot of it was too different. I mean, the FBI stuff is probably the most obvious difference. But there is, because it's very much dealt with kind of offhandedly at the end of the book by Dahl.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always established that Matilda's father, as played by Danny DeVito, is a crooked used car salesman.
Yeah.
That is his character. But it's only really dealt with at the end of the book that he's been kind of under suspicion of breaking the law.
Yeah.
Therefore, it kind of works cinematically to, like, sow the seeds with regards to that.
Yeah. Yeah, now, it's not particularly egregious.
Whether or not you need Matilda confronting them or not, that's a different matter. But, I mean, I think by and large, it sticks to, like, the main beats of the story pretty well. I mean, regardless of to what extent Dahl would have liked or not liked it, I think the spirit is obviously there. And you've got, like, one of the most talented child actors of her day in Mara Wilson to play the role. Okay, she's 9 playing a 6-year-old, and there's obviously a bit of a difference, but it's a very strong central performance. Something we might get onto a bit later. Yes, DeVito, we picked him because he's the kind of lead voice of this, not just as the director, but also the narrator. As well as Mr. Wormwood. But I think the parents are maybe secondary villains in the book overall.
Yes.
Because, yes, obviously they're neglectful, but they don't do anything physically abusive to her, unless I'm misremembering anything. Whereas you've got Miss Trunchbull, who's the primary antagonist, although she's more the antagonist to everyone rather than just solely Matilda, if that makes sense.
Yes, she's a kind of a baddie for everybody. I guess you're right, they are kind of, the Wormwoods are the localised villain, or...
they're the kind of Thénardiers compared to Trunchbull's Javert.
Okay. I will take that and lock it down. Yeah, no, you're absolutely
Wormwood,
right.
Wormwood, at last we see each other plain.
For goodness sake, Ma.
You little girl, get inside for choking. Before you say another word, Trunchbull.
I
went on a flight of fancy there.
Oh, look at you go.
Yes.
You love it. She loves it. I forgot what I was going to say, but yeah, it's,
antagonists.
Antagonists, yeah. It's a bit odd to have the main antagonist be the narrator as well. And I remember feeling that as a child as well, that there's, because Danny DeVito's got quite a recognizable raspy voice, which is usually shouting, but in this case is still him, just softer. It is a little bit weird to have Matilda Wormwood was a horror. Hey, Matilda, you fucking asshole! You know, like, within the same breath, it's kind of a little bit off-putting. So I think that's the only major drawback with this film from a kind of directorial standpoint.
Although that's only if you consider the narrator is meant to be DeVito in character as Wormwood.
Well, I don't think it is.
I think he clearly isn't.
It clearly isn't, but it's a style. I mean, he was the director of this film, so he decided, true, yes. He decided, you know, I will narrate this film and also play the main antagonist, me, with my very distinct voice. So there, for somebody who was a bit more literal-minded, would be thinking, ha, why is Mr. Wormwood being such an arsehole and then being really nice on the, maybe in headcanon, this is like an old Mr. Wormwood looking back on his life and going, I was a terrible father, and now I'm going to talk about my darling girl. That's my dad.
From Guam.
We're going to Guam. So I think that's the only misstep, as it were. But it is interesting to have him write the theme tune, sing the theme tune, as you say. He produced it, directed it, and he narrated it.
Well, this was him kind of getting more into family stuff, because not just Matilda was he in 1996, he was also in Space Jam.
Indeed he was.
And then Hercules was a year later.
I mean, by this point, he's got his recognisable voice in order to play the Space Jam villain and call me Phil.
Yes. Yeah. But this is cake. by which I mean Bruce Bogtrotter.
Indeed.
What a segue.
Yeah, very good.
As good as DeVito is, as, you know, an unpleasant fit, because, I mean, compare and contrast with Trunchbull, because You've got the fact that because he ripped up a library book, mm-hmm. that gives Matilda the excuse to start pulling pranks on him, which includes, I mean, they're pretty minor in the grand scheme of things. Making him accidentally peroxide his hair.
Yep.
And then gluing his hat onto his head.
Indeed. This is pretty good. And it is well done. In the book, it's more, it's like the twits. He does that, and then another day she does that, and then another day that happens. In the film, and I think in the musical as well, they kind of combine these together in terms of like, oh, whilst we're here at this garage, why not I put this sticky glue onto the hat? Ha ha ha. I might be wrong on that one. But there was another prank that was missed out of the film, which is to do with Matilda using a parrot that could talk, and I think they convinced the family that the house was haunted, which I would have loved to have seen Danny DeVito going, oh my god, there's a fucking ghost! Harry, there's a ghost!
Wow. All the voices.
I know. I'm a man of many talents.
Yes.
Let me just reach for my ukulele. No, I won't bother this time. it is a well-directed film, I think. It knows what it needs to be. It's an imagining of a children's story, so it's kind of, it's clear and it's colourful, and it kind of shows the baddies to be really bad. We will come on to Pam Ferris.
That's the one.
Yeah, I keep getting her confused with Pam Ayres. Different. different Pam.
For our American listeners.
Pam Ayres
was a Cornish poet who found fame on television in the 1970s.
I wish I looked after my teeth.
Yes.
Anyway.
One of those new thump fake headlines, which was, I think it was like, I think the Foo Fighters had to pull out because of Dave Grohl's broken leg. It's like, Foo Fighters replaced by Pam Ayres. sorry, audience, that was very much, that was very much a joke for us.
That was so good.
I'm sure I've got the picture somewhere.
Reminds me of the day to day when they've got Newsnight Live. They've got like live age footage and there's Michael Fish. Or Michael Burke, rather. Oh, whatever. I love it. What fun. Anyway, back to this film review. Well-directed film. He has his cake and he eats it too in this film, Danny DeVito, because, okay, fine, there's a bit of a disconnect, but you can kind of forgive the very recognisable narrator voice and him playing one of the main antagonists in the film. He does very well with the direction as well. He was the producer on it too. He's kind of stamped all over this film, but still gives way to the central performances. In my mind, would be Mara Wilson, I don't think we've discussed much about Cousin Mara before. She is possibly the best child actor. She certainly has a really good run of form, and then got out before she became egregious.
Well, that's the thing. Now, I do want to talk about Cousin Mara.
Yes, because, indeed.
Because it was over the course of making this film that her mother, Auntie Wilson, was dying of breast cancer.
Indeed. She's super sad. So
DeVito and, you know, Rhea Perlman, his real-life wife, very much played very big parental figures to her to, you know, just help her through the process. And I understand they remain great friends to this day.
I mean, understandable, because they really looked after her. And I think their kids, Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman, were part of, they would have been around during the making of this film. So they really kind of became a little mini family with her, which is really nice and really kind.
Yeah.
And it's What a lovely, lovely guy Danny DeVito is. I think this is a really good film for him to show what he is as a general human being. So both in front of, behind, and kind of the narration underneath the camera, and outside of the production itself. It's just showing what he's all about, which is telling stories in a inclusive way with people that he likes and treats really nicely. And that includes Michael Douglas, his old mate, and Bob the Goon from back in the day. His wife on screen is his real wife of the time. And, you know, if you are a real kind of Hollywood geek, you would kind of see that and go, well, hang on a minute, he can't play with his actual wife, but it works.
Why not?
Well, I don't know, because there might be a bit of a disconnect.
I mean, they were both very famous. We'll touch on Rhea Perlman later, but...
Yeah, she was big in Cheers, wasn't she?
She had a renowned role in Cheers where she played a very abrasive waitress.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not going too far outside of what she was good at doing, but that was what she was known for.
Yeah.
And she could play it up. And I think, you know, the very last time you actually see that character, there is a bit of a, oh, well, you know what? I can do this for you. Obviously, it just didn't work out. So I didn't see what I had with regard to you. And I do think it was slightly funny that Matilda just so happened to have adoption papers in her back pocket.
Yes. Matilda, you're my only daughter. I never understood you, not for one little minute. Who's got a pen? Isn't that great? And that's not in the book. That is a rewriting of the script. Who did the screenplay? It wasn't Danny DeVito as well, was it?
Probably not.
Screenplay by Nicholas Kazan and Robin Swickord.
Of course.
Fine. Good for them. But yeah, it's a funny line and it's a good showing for them. But yeah, going back to what I was saying before, it's a lovely film... For, like, inside and out, as it were, that you can watch it and enjoy it and then feel good about how it was made rather than kind of a, I don't know, maybe a, God, what's his name? Who's the guy who talks like this? Who's Werner Herzog? A Werner Herzog film, which is really sad to watch. And as you know, they went through hell to try and make the film in the first place because our life is meaningless. It would be interesting to see the version of Matilda done by Werner Herzog, where Werner Herzog plays Mr. Wormwood, as well as doing all of the narration as well. Matilda Wormwood was the child who will one day die, as will we all.
What the hell is going on?
Hello?
What was that?
That was me turning into Werner Herzog.
Oh, of course.
And having a monologue about what it would be like to... Anyway. But my point stands. Werner Herzog likes depressing things, but Danny DeVito... I think Danny DeVito is the opposite of Werner Herzog. There you go. I've called it.
Okay.
There we go. Add that to the copy. Stick that in your copy and smoke it.
Who am I to disagree?
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about Danny DeVito's acting performance. He is a bastard!
Is that because he's short, like in The Hobbit?
No, that's not why. No, he does really well being this larger-than-life asshole, and a really kind of
which is
skeezy,
ironic, really.
I mean, yes, because he's a tiny goblin man.
He
does very well with this. Being sort of scuzzy and evil and happy about it. This is very much the kind of origin story of his character Frank in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. The kind of scheming, swindling, kind of sell his own mother for some money kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, he does it really well despite being a really nice guy.
Yeah. No, I can't fault him. I think he's... you know, he knows what the assignment is. You need to make Mr. Wormwood be, you know, a terrible father to rail against. And DeVito's up to the task.
Indeed.
And, yeah, the same goes for Rhea Perlman. To a lesser extent, she's more neglectful than she is outright spiteful, I think.
Yeah.
I think they actually made the brother more spiteful as well.
Yeah,
I seem to recall in the book,
Like, when the Wormwoods are leaving for the final time, it's like the brother actually waves at her through the car.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a kind of sadness to the brother, but I think it's more that he's a bit kind of gormless and doesn't understand what the hell's going on. So he's kind of like the opposite of Matilda. If Matilda got all the smarts, he got all the dumbs. And as a result, it's kind of ironic that they think he's the best thing. And he's, because he's the boy, the firstborn, he's going to be the one to inherit the brilliant legacy. Aren't you brilliant? Look, he's eating TV, eating TV meals like us. Whereas, you know, the one who's bookish and studious is a fuck up and a mistake. Adding to the horribleness, the plight of our poor... It's adding to the plight of our poor Matilda, who was never nurtured by her parents.
Okay. Right. You've got a new character.
Having Werner Herzog come to visit. Yes. Let's talk about Pam Ferris.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I'm going, you go. She's great.
Okay, so, clearly, because Hollywood is full of beautiful people who they often have to ugly up if there are, you know, ugly characters to portray, I think they did have to delve far and wide to find Pam Ferris, aka Mar Larkin, the screen mother of former Haar subject Catherine Zeta-Jones.
In the Darling Buds of May.
In the Darling Buds of May. Who would have... I mean, she would have been a slightly heavy-set actress in her mid-40s at the time that this was being filmed.
Right.
But they did their best to really make her... I mean, kind of East European, really, which is the kind of... It's the joke about the kind of East European female shot putters or hammer throwers. It's like a quip. I don't know who to attribute it to. It's like you could just about see the outline of their bollocks through there.
That's a Linda Smith line.
Something like that, yeah. So I think that's very much the aesthetic they were going for. And so...
You've reminded me of a silly Andy Zaltzman-esque joke about, I really enjoyed watching the Olympics. God, all the track and field events were very exciting, and it culminated with the winner of the javelin competition. Big finish? Yes, I believe she was Scandinavian. Anyway.
One of my comedy chums currently has a routine around Olympic netball.
Oh, okay.
So, remember how it goes.
Is it filthy?
Good. No, I just can't remember how it goes.
Oh, that's alright then. Fine, good.
But I believe we're performing together tomorrow.
So, oh, what fun. You can do a double act.
Not together, I mean on the same...
On the same bill. Okay, fine. Yes. I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right in terms of they've done a good job of making her look Hollywood ugly, which is, it's kind of, it plays to the strength of her performance that she is going out and out arch on this one. Like, full on tweed suits, hair tied back in a horrendous greasy way, and they've kind of painted her upper lip hair because, God forbid, women should have hair anywhere other than their heads.
I think one of the best things I can say about how DeVito's vision has come across is that all of the villains do look like they are walking, talking Quentin Blake illustrations.
That's a very good point.
I think the way that Pam Ferris is dolled up as Miss Trunchbull is very much akin to how she's illustrated in the book.
Yeah.
I've high marks on the conceptual design. And then just guessing her to do the terrible things that she does, like chucking the student around by her pigtails, and then the Bruce Bogtrotter cake punishment as well.
Indeed. Yeah. It's very... She's hugely larger than life / cartoonish.
To the point of the kind of like cat and mouse chase through the mansion.
Oh God, she's legitimately terrifying. Like the whole kind of the bit, the weird sort of white, like close up where she looks around with a kind of savage look in her eye, and then her like charging full pelt, and Mara Wilson looking terrified, and Miss Honey looking terrified on her behalf. It's a really well done thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of plays within the terrifyingness of she's the stakes. I mean, Matilda has learned to deal with her shitcake parents, whereas in this film there is now a horrible antagonist who probably would kill someone because it's implied she's done it before very, very heavily and is actively cruel towards Miss Honey, who is the best person, apparently.
Hmm. And for which Matilda's like, I know, I've got telekinesis powers. I can do something about this. Because she doesn't use her telekinesis on her dad. It's just for the Trunchbull.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Miss Honey, I mean, you know, she's quite a soft character, but I think she's played as she should be.
Say again, Miss Honey.
Yeah.
Yes, she is reasonably nothing in terms of her characterization. She is just, oh, she's the nice one, and Matilda likes her, and, you know, that's kind of it. And, yeah, it's fine. She's given a lot more to do in the musical, but you don't really miss, like, her depths of her story in this film too much. She gets one real big monologue which explains the kind of more of the danger of Trunchbull and why she, a lovely, wonderful person, is in such a horrible situation. But, you know, they do a good job of giving her just enough character without it distracting from everything else going on.
Yeah. Now, do you remember where we've seen Ember Davids before?
No. Did we bump into her in Sainsbury's one day?
So she featured prominently in one of our year one featured films.
Oh, really?
Now, admittedly, it was a very strange film.
Oh,
but
Dark Tide?
No. If I were to say it was for Amy Adams month.
Oh, was she in Junebug?
She was the lead woman in Junebug.
Oh.
So okay. The one who married into the family of brothers.
Oh, and therefore Amy Adams was the weird sister-in-law.
The fiancé of the younger brother.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I remember her being kind of funny in a way.
Very oddball, quirky kind of humour to that film.
She's like an art dealer, isn't she?
And she was, yes.
She's kind of inspired by this horrible artist who everyone thinks is incredible, but it's just a madman who paints naked things.
That's
basically right,
I
should rewatch that film. It's been a while.
Well, as I say, year one.
Yes, so, yeah. It's been at least 15 years.
not quite that long.
Oh, 25 years.
Other things about the film. I'm not sure I came away with anything particular in mind. It's like I don't remember much about like the music, say, or anything like that. I just thought it was a very nice retelling of the classic story.
There's
really
two songs that, for me, come out of this film that are kind of the sort of ubiquitous with anyone who'd seen Matilda. That was the version of Ill Biddy Pretty One when she's doing her...
That's more of the humming, isn't it?
And I remember distinctly being at school, and I think that was put on in a music lesson or something, and everyone went, oh, it's Matilda, and then everyone going, wah, 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 wah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry for bursting everyone's eardrums there, my bad. And then the overly used song Send Me On My Way, which seems to come on in lots and lots of films around this time, most notably Matilda and the Ice Age films, at least one of the films. I would like to close your eyes. I would like to close my eyes. I'll go remember okay. that one?
No.
Maybe they say, maybe they are. You'd recognise it if you heard it. Okay. It's the one right at the beginning and right at the end when they're doing like yoga and making pancakes and stuff.
Sure.
Or making cakes, rather. Yeah, it's the soundtrack is there and it's fine. There's the two standout songs for me personally. But, yeah, it's a well-made kids film.
It is. Now, it was seen as a box office disappointment. It wasn't a bomb, but it was made for $36 million and recouped $47 million. So it was $11 million in profit, but seemingly they were hoping for more.
Aww. Well, never mind.
But as you said, it was one of those films that did a lot better where it was released on video. And critical reception, 92% approval on Rotten Tomatoes.
Hooray! Good stuff. I mean, well done. That's all we need to know. Well done, Danny DeVito. Good job. It's a well done thing. Was this... I mean, maybe we'll get into it more when we do his entire filmography from start to end in painstaking detail, but was this one of his early directorial forays?
This was kind of like mid career, because he was really directing through the 80s as well. So we talked about War of the Roses.
Yeah, of course. I know he directed a few episodes of Taxi as well, just to kind of get his eye in.
Sure. but he also, but War of the Roses, which was 1989, that was actually the third feature-length film that he directed
okay.
by that point. So he'd also directed his chum, Jack Nicholson in Hoffa in 1992.
Uh-huh.
And then he had a couple more, although both of those were very badly received comedies.
Oh.
So we can touch upon them after we get into that section. But let's drop in a clip from Matilda.
Okay.
And when we come back, we can talk about Danny DeVito at large.
He's
small. He's a very small man. For our American listeners, Dennis White. Here's the clip.
They named her Matilda.
You're supposed to eat the spinach. Babies. You're better off raising tomatoes.
By the time she was two, Matilda had learned what most people learn in their early 30s. How to take care of herself. As time went by, she developed a sense of style. Every morning, Matilda's older brother, Michael, went to school.
Come on, get out of here.
Her father went to work selling used cars for unfair prices. And her mother took off to play bingo.
Soup's on the stove. Heat it up if you get hungry.
Matilda was left alone. That was how she liked it.
Well, pick me up golden hand. So, brother, Danny DeVito is, as I think I alluded to earlier, an actor who I've really kind of always been aware of, because I think he was having his big kind of blockbuster heyday around the late 80s and then early through mid 90s. So he's just one of those people who was on movies, games and videos quite a lot.
I was going to mention movies, games and videos. I'm pretty sure I remember, because we kind of liked Batman as a, wow, he's cool looking.
Mm.
I'm sure there was something about the Batman film that was going to be released on home video very soon.
We knew he was the Penguin, yes.
Right.
And as I say, I believe that Matilda was the first of his films that I saw in the cinema. But again, as alluded to in that review, then shortly thereafter, Space Jam.
I love Space Jam. That was the perfect age for Space Jam.
Really? I guess I think I've only seen it maybe twice.
Really?
I think so.
I have an abiding memory of it being rented. We never owned it. We rented it. And I watched it on our grandma's VHS.
Oh, wow.
And like being way too close to the TV and just drinking it in. She was probably doing stuff in the background rather than watching in at the same time. But yeah, I remember feeling really grown up that I laughed at the. I didn't realise that Dan Aykroyd was in this movie joke and understanding it.
Because, hey, that's not Dan Aykroyd, that's Bill Murray.
even at that age, I kind of went, hang on a minute, they're two people who are often in each other's films.
Very much so. And then Hercules the year after, which again, we would have seen, we almost certainly saw in the cinema.
I think we watched it like three times in the cinema.
No, I couldn't tell you how many times I saw it in the cinema.
I know we watched it loads.
That we did have on video, so we did watch it quite a bit.
Yeah.
And also, what great voice casting in Hercules, by the way.
I know, right? It's a problematic Disney film in some ways, in terms of tone. James Woods notwithstanding.
Because.
To have her... I mean, it's another kind of example of a Disney stunt casting, which was in its heyday at the time. And I think Danny DeVito would probably be the biggest name check person in there. Certainly to appeal to the youth, because I don't know many young people at the time who would have known who James Woods is.
That is fair. Yeah.
Was. And they kind of made the character look a little bit like him. So, you know, it's like the genie, but in goat god form.
Yeah. A very fun film.
Very fun. More on that later.
Do you remember off the top of your head who was Christian's co-host for that on Part of Your World?
Off the top of my head, no. I could do some digging if you wish.
By all means. So I can kick off. So whilst we said that Taxi was kind of his big break in terms of fame, he was doing film work in the 70s. None of them were huge films, I would have said. There was a film in 1973 directed by Kirk Douglas called Scalawag, which was a Western retelling of Treasure Island.
Lol.
But I think his kind of big film role was the aforementioned One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 1975.
Now, have you seen that film?
I have seen. I've got that on DVD.
And I gather he's meant to do a very good version of a kind of mentally ill person, which is a bit problematic in a way, but it's not a kind of simple Jack from Tropic Thunder.
Oh no,
kind of
no.
Vibe.
It's very. It plays very well with the inmates, for want of a better word, of a mental institution. I mean, you remember how we covered Girl Interrupted?
Yes.
For Weird Ain't a Rider. It's that kind of thing. It's right. Like, they're not portrayed to be, you know, comedic relief or fucking idiots or anything like that. They're people who are there because they've got very overt mental illness, and the people there, obviously you've got Jack Nicholson who stars, because the whole conceit is he is in there, but he's seemingly like playing like mental illness card to get to what he sees as a cushier kind of prison. But you know, it's not just DeVito, it's also his later Taxi co-star, Christopher Lloyd. And also Brad Dourif, who's a well-known Hollywood villain. But in this one, he was playing a very sympathetic young inmate. Dourif is probably best known as the voice of Chucky in the Child's Play films.
Okay.
But he's been all sorts.
Let's say earlier we were talking about overtly American names. Brian DeReef sounds like some Californian stoner surfer.
Brad DeReef.
Brad DeReef?
Yeah. I mean,
surf's up, dude. I'm Brad DeReef.
I think you could probably best pitch because you're a big Lord of the Rings fan. He's Grimer Wormtongue.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Oh, nice.
But this is like 30 years before, or 25 years before Lord of the Rings.
Right.
So.
Oh, cool.
So it's an interesting film. Definitely if we do Jack Nicholson, that one would basically be on the docket.
Smashing.
But then, you know, so Taxi was taking up most of his time from the late 70s through the early 80s.
I was going to say, I have not seen anything of Taxi, but in my kind of research for this episode, it was really interesting to hear people's opinions about, initially, his first appearance is a height gag, as in, like, they've got this thing built up where the operator, the kind of running of the place, works in, and that's Danny DeVito, and he kind of marches out of this booth and goes down some steps while going, "I need to be harsh with you boys!" And they're kind of going, "Ah ha 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 ha, tiny man shout at people, ah ha ha."
Yeah.
But it's like, throughout the show, it's not just a hype joke lazily done. There is like heart attached to it as well. And he's somebody who lent into his stature really well and was hugely adaptable and open about, you know, who he is as a person. And there's a lot of heart to his performance, which is possibly why he did so well leaving Taxi and going into other media.
Indeed. Now, before he did, he did have like side projects, as did Kaufman, obviously, over mm-hmm. the period of Taxi being made. I think the thing that's most prominent is that at the second ever Golden Raspberry Awards, he was nominated for a Golden Raspberry for Worst Supporting Actor for his supporting role in Going Ape, which, according to Wikipedia, is a film that starred Tony Danza, Danny DeVito, and three orangutans.
The Dunstan checks in of its day.
I suppose this is, yes.
Was there Faye Dunaway in there as
no,
well?
No, there was not. No.
Okay.
Danny DeVito is by far the most famous person in that. Without throwing any shade to Tony Danza. That's one for the Americans.
Tony Danza, I'm getting confused with... who's the guy from Cheers? Who's the good guy?
Are you talking about Ted...
Ted Danson?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, not Tony Danza. No. Similar, but not.
Yeah, kind of. Was in the very famous 1983 tragicomedy, Terms of Endearment... which Jack Nicholson was also in, as was Jeff Daniels, John Lithgow, but it was more of a star turn looking at the relationship between Shirley MacLaine of Bernie fame and Deborah Winger, a star back in the day who you never hear talked about. So there we go. And then again, we go into the fact that he was building his way up through supporting roles. So Romancing the Stone, as covered earlier, in 1984. And then Johnny Dangerously, which was a parody of 1930s gangster movies, starring his future Batman opponent, Michael Keaton.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
So there we are. The Romancing the Stone sequel, Jewel of the Nile, followed in 1985. His first kind of starring role came in 1986 in a film headed by Brian De Palma, Phantom of the Paradise and Carrie fame, called Wise Guys, which was him and Joe Piscopo, famously of the Karate Kid, the manic dojo guy.
The manic dojo
guy.
Love it. I'm just thinking, like, Wise Guys got to be said. Hey, Wise Guys. Is that, like, the whole point of it? Is it a crime film?
I don't know. And then, also in 1986, he and Rhea Perlman lent their voices to My Little Pony, the movie, which I know for a fact that we did watch, because it was the ponies taking on some witch sisters with the schmooze purple slime kind of monster creature.
Oh. Okay, I do not remember.
You have no memory of it, that is fine.
I have no memory of it, but I'm not going to doubt that it was a thing.
He
played someone called the Grundle King.
That's right. That sounds like a Danny DeVito role to me.
Grundle's the taint.
Sure. What?
The Gooch, wait. The Grundle, the Perineum.
I've never heard it called the Grundle.
Have you not?
The Gooch and the taint, yes. The Grundle.
Yeah, there's all sorts of magical words for it.
Well, clearly. There we go. he was in a couple of rather famous films in 1987. There's Tin Men, starring Richard Dreyfuss of Jaws fame. And then his dark comedy film that he also directed, Throw Mama from the Train.
Indeed,
which
yeah.
Co-starred with Billy Crystal.
And the mum from the Goonies.
Anne Ramsey, yes.
Yeah. Again, not seen that. I've seen a lot of things about his directorial style, and this was a real big showcase of him doing it very, very cartoonishly over-the-top slapstick, but also very dark as well. And you see that in a lot of his films. Mm. And we mentioned it briefly when we talked about Matilda, that he makes his characters, when he's a director, he makes them larger than life and lots of real close-up things to not show them as monsters, but to show them as kind of overtly weird and how the madness has gripped them just for that moment. It looks really interesting, and I'd be interesting to watch it at some point if we did like a Billy Crystal month.
Yeah, sure. And then 1988, he started his comedic partnership with Arnold Schwarzenegger in a film that
he was Arnie's half brother.
In the film we covered for Arnold Schwarzenegger month, Twins. So you can go back in to the archive and listen to that.
Rerun the fun on that one.
War of the Roses, which was the quasi sequel to Romancing the Stone Jewel of the Nile, was 1989. And then,
and again, real over the top, surrealist direction from him.
Yes, absolutely.
Whilst always also being in it as well, he does like to stamp himself on his own films, which might wreak a little bit of vanity, but it's done well for him.
Case in point, 1992, he had the biographical crime drama, which he directed, of Hoffa, which is about the longtime Teamsters union leader Jimmy Hoffa, who famously disappeared, with Jack Nicholson playing Jimmy Hoffa and DeVito playing his mate. It was meant to be. Also that year, he was the Penguin.
Do you remember comments on... Oh, yeah, I know you've already covered it in various different forums, the Dark Knight discussions being one of them. Kind of grotesque, but also a little bit funny as well.
That is correct, yes. I think what's interesting is that Nicholson, fresh off of playing the Joker, and got a shit ton of money off of that because he accepted like a small upfront fee and then wanted a gross of the film's profits and merchandising.
Okay.
And this is like late 80s Batman, so Batman... It was starting to become more culturally relevant in the comics, but in media, it still had the long shadow of Adam West cast over it. So Nicholson basically got a deal that Warner Brothers couldn't have imagined would pay out as well as it did. And so Nicholson's coining it in. He's like, hey, Danny, you want to get rich? Be a Batman villain. And...
exactly. I'll do it, you asshole.
Exactly. And then he had a voice cameo in Schwarzenegger's Last Action Hero. And then he reteamed with Schwarzenegger properly in 1994 for the film Junior.
Yeah.
Which I have seen.
I have seen as well, not for a very long time, and I know it contains a certain... Oh, no, hang on. No, it wasn't her in that one. She was in Twins. Oh, never mind.
You're thinking of Heather Graham.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be Heather.
You're always thinking of Heather. Heather Graham.
I was thinking of Heather Graham. Wonderful mother she would be.
Indeed.
Anyway.
But, you know, Mother Wilson does well enough, I think.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, that would be wit. No. Oh, God. In 1995, ironically, he was in a film called Get Shorty.
Yes.
Where various people, including John Travolta and Gene Hackman, were trying to find him.
Well,
I don't know. No, I'm not seeing
they
it.
They certainly made up the supporting cast. It's a gangster comedy film directed by future Men in Black director Barry Sonnenfeld.
Oh, cool. I'm sure it was a lot of fun.
Yes, it was between Adam's Family Values and Men in Black. So,
got you.
I seem to recall Get Shorty was quite well received at the time, if memory serves. And then we've just talked about his kind of run of kids' films in the mid-90s. He did have an uncredited alien cameo in Men in Black, apparently. and then Man on the Moon was 1999. He also had a role in one of Kirsten Dunst's breakout films called The Virgin Suicides.
That sounds funny.
Yeah, we didn't cover that in that was from 1999. We didn't cover that in either Kirsten Dunst month because she had a lot of breakout film roles around that time, and
she broke out so many times.
She sure did.
She must be allergic to something.
Hey, and then so there are other kind of less well known. Comedies going into the millennium. I want to just mention Heist from 2001 because it's a crime drama written and directed by David Mamet, who I believe also wrote Hoffa, but it starred him, Gene Hackman, and your favourite, who's had a career renaissance of late, Delroy Lindo.
All right, I know his name now.
Yeah. Finally.
Delboy Leroy. Delroy Lindo.
Yes, it just took an Oscar nomination.
And a high-profile gaff at the BAFTAs.
Yeah, yes. Not his gaff.
Which is very unfortunate.
Not his
gaff. No, no, no.
Him reacting.
Unfortunately, he was attached to it, though.
Yes, unfortunately so.
Which is meant to be the whole point of the film, but it's, I mean, it's just a bad, bad situation. But anyway,
yes.
Let's move on from
moving on to 2002, one of his most quotable cameos ever. Hey, asshole! I'm Mini-Me! Hey,
it's me! I'm Mini-Me!
From
I think we should also mention...
We should just
briefly,
say that's Goldmember, the third
Austin
Powers film.
Yes, Austin Powers and Gold.
Yes.
Yeah, very in the fake version of Austin Powers. But the same year, he was in a film called Death to Smoochie.
Yes,
that he directed,
that's right.
Which I know John Stewart uses as like an example of a bad film because he was in it.
Yes.
And it's meant to be an objectively not great film, despite it having Robin Williams, Edward Norton, and...
John Stewart.
Himself, and John Stewart, yeah.
Yeah.
A surrealist comedy about a mascot and somebody wanting to kill him.
That's right. It's one of Robin Williams' more kind of one-hour photo kind of roles, where he's playing a very darkly comedic role. Now, I haven't seen it, but someone who swears, who will die on the hill, that it is a good slash interestingly comedic movie is Tom Hemmings.
Okay.
He's a big fan. And then also another blow to his directorial career in 2003 was the black comedy Duplex, in which, think Mouse Hunt, but the mouse is an old woman and Lee Evans and Nathan Lane are Ben Stiller and Drew Barrymore.
Ben Stiller and Drew Barrymore trying to kill an old woman.
They're trying to get an old woman out of, like, their dream duplex apartment.
I mean, that sounds amazing.
It was,
but it wasn't well received.
It was not well received, despite the fact, you know, it was very starry.
Okay.
But there we are.
I just want to see Drew Barrymore try to kill an old woman.
Yeah. And he was also in the Tim Burton 2003 film, which I've never seen before, Big Fish.
Oh, yeah, with good old Ewan McGregor.
Hmm. So there we go. 2005, there was the Get Shorty sequel, Be Cool, right. Which, interestingly, was an early supporting role for The Rock.
Yeah, I think that film's got a lot to answer for lately.
Is that
time of recording, they've just released the trailer for the live-action version of Moana.
All right.
Which, I don't see the point. I mean, I know why it's there. Cha-ching.
Yeah.
But they've taken The Rock and they've put him in a cosplay wig. And that's him being Maui. And I don't think you've probably not seen Moana itself.
That is correct.
You? Moana is a great film. Mm. Really, really well-told story. Very emotional. Hit me in exactly the right place at the right time. In terms of like a young woman overcoming and becoming herself and finding herself.
You could relate.
Legacy and whatever. Yeah. I could, not as a young woman, no. But yeah, wonderful film. I've not watched Moana 2, and then they've just kind of farted out a live-action version just because. And they've used The Rock again, because I know he's probably the best person for the role, but it just looks... It's pointless. Why? Why are they doing this? They have no artistic, like, value at all?
You could be saying this about pretty much any live-action...
How's
that part of your world research going?
Oh, really good.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I did find that. It was Donovan.
Oh, okay,
it.
Yeah. Because I think ancient Greece, I think Donovan Morgan Grant. Yes.
I mean, he's got the body of a Greek god,
That is a separate thing, yes.
since
the last time I spoke to him, he's become a bit of a first trap guy. But there we are.
Gosh, I must avoid that account. Tell me the name of it.
It's Donovan's Massive Abs on Instagram. Or something
I'm
like that.
I'm so glad you said abs. anyway, on a completely unrelated topic to Donovan in the nude, in 2008 he was in a film called Just Add Water.
2006, he was in a Christmas comedy called Deck for Halls, opposite Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, cool.
I just say that because it's well known. He was in. Have you ever watched the TV show Reno 911?
No, I have not.
Have you ever heard of it?
I think I'm conflating it with something else.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
No, that's something else.
Okay.
Police car down on the ground.
Okay, well, he was in one of those movies, and then I think, by and large, there's like certain films here and there. For Lorax, he was the voice of.
Indeed,
he was in the here you go, a live action Disney film for Dumbo. He was the ringmaster, which I haven't seen. But given that I can picture the, because that was my, one of my part of your world contributions was the animated Dumbo.
Okay.
You can see how casting DeVito for the Ringmaster makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I do hope at some point his, kind of bib thing around his neck kind of reels upwards like a scroll. That'd be very funny.
Speaking of The Rock, apparently he's been in some of the Jumanji films.
Jumanji 2, The Next Level.
Yeah.
And the unreleased, as of yet, third in the trilogy. I watched the first one of those, and I found it really funny.
Okay.
It's very self-aware.
Hey, you're not Robin Williams.
Busted. In the film. It's really good. I don't know about the second one. Kel liked it, which is not a good indictment of it. But, you know, safe pair of hands going in. We need... He's kind of now... I don't want to kind of jump over the last few films in his filmography too much, but he's now a kind of stunt... Yeah, he's a stunt cast kind of more recently.
Sure.
As in, like, who could we get to play this old man? Ah, of course, it's got to be Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And therefore, he was in Beetlejuice, yes. The second one. He's in a film called Pool Man with Chris Pine, which is meant to be quite an interesting one.
Why pools, Master Wayne? Pools frighten me, Alfred.
The chlorine levels are too high. But something we skipped over, which is possibly why some of his more recent film roles have been more kind of stunty.
Slightly different medium if you're heading where I think you're heading.
Yeah, indeed. In 2006, he joined the cast of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Now, have you watched much of It's Always Sunny?
I have watched a lot of clip compilations, and I've seen a few episodes in full. Bear in mind, I just don't watch a lot of TV full stop, and I know It's Always Sunny, I know those episodes are really short, but... everything I've seen of It's Always Sunny, I've really enjoyed.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. He's obviously done lots of TV over the years. He got his big break from Taxi and has kind of carried that through with him. And he's had some star turns and some cameos in things like Friends and The Larry Sanders Show.
The Simpsons.
He was Homer Simpson's half brother.
Yeah.
Starring in it as recently as 2024.
Oh, wow.
So they obviously brought that back a bit. Yeah. But It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is probably one of his longest running, well, definitely one of his longest running roles. And I've watched pretty much everything up to a point, and then I just got behind on it and haven't found the time or the inclination to kind of do it. But it's really interesting to watch the first series of it, first season of it, which doesn't have him in.
Right.
And then see it change from the second season onwards, which does have it on. And having him in there really does make it.
Right, yeah.
It was a funny enough show to begin with, and then him being in there as the kind of older, sleazy, horrible trash fire of a guy. He does so well. It plays to all his kind of... the vulgarity you see of him as the Penguin.
Yeah.
But also the hearts that he plays in Matilda and the kind of the douchebaggery of Mr. Wormwood. There's so much of the different roles we've seen of Danny DeVito mixed into one disgusting, scummy person in Frank Reynolds. It's a great role. I mean, they at no point make him sympathetic.
True of all the characters, isn't it?
Absolutely. But they have their moments.
Yeah.
Like, there was a really powerful episode where one of the characters, they may have undone it now, I don't know, but they kind of explain why he's so conflicted and so macho and has terrible values, because he has been gay and not realized it throughout the entirety of his life. And there's one episode where he's trying to convince his own father, who is a gangster in prison. He does an interpretive dance to kind of show who he is as a person. And, you know, it's built up as, oh, God, you're not going to dance in prison in front of this guy. The dance itself, and this is one of the guys who owns Watford FC, Aaron McElmore. I can't remember his name, McElvaney.
You mean Wrexham, for one thing.
What did I say?
Watford.
The
ownership of Watford is more Elton John.
Yeah, sorry. Fine. Rob McElhenney, there you go.
Rob Mac, it's a really... as he's rebranding himself.
Yeah, Mac. Yeah, quite right. He does his wonderful interpretive dance, and the end of the episode is just a kind of zoom in on Danny DeVito as Frank Reynolds with him saying, I get it. And that's just it. It's this really powerful moment of, like, exposing himself to somebody else, but it holds water, and you need the heart of Danny DeVito to pull that off properly. But you can still have that moment, despite seeing him in various other episodes where he does the worst things possible. Russian roulette in the basement, and
is it implied he's in the Epstein files or something like that?
Probably. I'm sure it is. There's a great parody moment in one of his early seasons where he does like a kind of castaway line where they're floating on a Lilo out in the sea. Instead of shouting for Wilson the football, he's shouting, "Where's my rum ham? Rum ham!" Because he really wants to eat this ham that's been soaked in rum. And it's kind of his raspy shouting. It's wonderful. So if you're looking at a role that kind of encompasses all that an actor can do across a wide variety of a career, a long spanning 50 year plus career,
yeah,
it's him being Frank Reynolds in Always Sunny.
Yeah.
And it gets naked and crawls out of a sofa, yes, at some point.
Famously, yes.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was DeVito, somewhere on social media, a girl took a cardboard cut out of Danny DeVito to her prom as her date.
I can believe
and
that.
Then DeVito found out about it and got a cardboard copy of her mate or something to pose with. So, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Again, like the Pam Ayres Glastonbury thing, I don't think I'm going to find it in time, but never mind.
He's still in films to this day. He's still doing odds and sods here, there and everywhere, but he seems like a really nice guy who gets really on really well with people. And as we said in the Matilda review, he's kind of got a tribe and treats people well, and it seems like he's got the pick of the litter in terms of what he wants to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, he's been in a relationship with Rhea Perlman since 1971.
Indeed.
So after one of them saw another in a play. And they got married in 1982. They actually separated in 2012, reconciled in 2013, separated again in 2017, but they have absolutely no intention to divorce. It's just a case of they see each other as, basically great friends, great soulmates. They just don't want to necessarily be married. And think about how much healthier that kind of separation is compared to former half subject Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see Danny DeVito slapping anyone in the face at the Oscars. He might headbutt them in the balls, but that's a different thing.
I mean, they've got this personable relationship. They are also founders of Jersey Films, a production company as well, which is responsible for films including Pulp Fiction, Erin Brockovich, and Gattaca, which we covered.
Gattaca.
In which Ethan Hawke got a car.
Oh, no. No.
It's that joke again. I know, right?
Oh, dear. And I keep mentioning how Danny DeVito has been childhood friends with Jack Nicholson, Michael Douglas, and various people. That's not.
And Rod the Goon.
Tracy Walter is his name.
Sorry.
That's not quite true. I keep seeing things here and there about how they all grew up together, which isn't quite true. Although DeVito and Michael Douglas, did share an apartment together as young actors, and then I think obviously the bond of friendship between DeVito and Nicholson is because they were both from the kind of same area of New Jersey and such, right. So that's where the association kind of comes in. But yeah, I haven't seen anyone have a bad word to say about Danny DeVito. Despite the fact that he comes across as quite abrasive, but then that's more in the kind of roles that he plays as opposed to the guy himself. I mean, just, what he did for Mara Wilson during the filming of Matilda, that just sells me on just how good a human being he is. Despite the fact that, he sounds like a grumpy arsehole.
It's, you're quite right. But then equally, he's had like financial success as well from his production.
Sure, yeah.
He's got to be fairly hard-headed, so he's no kind of pushover. He seems to have the best of all situations. Now, whether that's because of he has a bone condition, which means he's kind of short in stature. And I'd like to think, and this is definitely kind of me extending my own stereotypical thinking of what might have happened, who knows? But, you know, growing up looking very different to somebody else will give somebody a kind of outward look, and being a little bit kind of hard-nosed,
sure,
which probably informed a lot of his kind of tough performances. But at the same time, he is a heartful, is that even a word? His performances are full of heart. So I, in loving reverence to him,
just before the segue, I just want to slip in a joke. He is also, if you believe in regional stereotypes, he is also from New Jersey.
Yeah. He's a Jersey boy.
He sure is. Anyway, sorry.
Cousins with Snooki.
Continue.
But so I wrote a song parody based on a song from one of the films what he was in.
Ooh.
And this is my take and my dedication to Danny DeVito.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Bless my soul. Dan's had lots of roles.
Acting and producing and directing films and shows.
Boy, you bet. Striking silhouette. Can you name a genre that he hasn't been in yet? Small but impactful.
Tiny Goblin.
There is a honcho.
Film star Kingpin.
Tiny in stature, but act he can.
Danny DeVito. I'm a fan.
Danny DeVito. A funny man.
Shaggy when he gets angry.
His eyes are cute through his showbiz roots. His showbiz roots.
From tragedies to comedies, roles earnest and vulgar. Now legendary status.
He played Homer Simpson's half-brother.
The Penguin then was on his twin.
Not afraid of reinvention, not afraid to show some skin.
Safe pair of hands and
and this adaptation's done it well for 50 years.
Sending his skills of many uses. Honey, the extra is and produces. Movie products is pretty much free. Danny DeVito
likes Bernie.
Danny DeVito.
Tee-hee-hee. Who put the man in the second Jumanji?
Danny D.
And the life has come back and always sunny.
Danny D.
What's he doing with that stone?
He is romancing Danny D. Danny D. Danny D. Danny D. Danny D. Danny D. Oh, bless my soul, there's another rose. Raspy shouting, not too high.
And the nicest guy.
So far, I'm on outings. But I'm not creeping. Turn the feet on. To the real moment. Boy, Bonito. Boys in the door, let's go.
I'd like to thank the Miss Piggy singers for that heartfelt song.
They are all big fans as well. Ladies and gentlemen, the Miss Piggy players. I had to stop talking for a few hours after finishing that.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, let's look to the future, shall we?
Well, on that fitting tribute to Danny DeVito's 50-year career, thank you again to the Miss Piggy singers. We move on to the next episode, and we've gone with, as was announced earlier in the year, the most profitable, bankable actor of all time, surpassing who? I think it was Samuel L. Jackson previously,
or possibly, or Tom Cruise.
Oh yeah, well, one of the two. It's neither. It's someone without a penis. It's Zoe Saldana.
Hooray!
That's right. We are covering three films of Zoe Saldana. And we've narrowed it down, thanks to all the input on the forum / Facebook, which apparently I didn't do. So what? It got done. So we've got three films, none of which involve the MCU the Star Trek franchise, in fact, which now that we've said that out loud, I'm realizing it's going to piss off Org. although it's a good way of getting feedback, I think.
Yeah.
Oh shit. That reminds me. We have feedback from the Orcs. But we'll play it after we carry on with these film announcements.
Okay.
So we will say up front, so it's Pandy's homework that's going to start off the episode. So I've chosen for you, brother. You know how we're just biopic crazy at the moment.
Indeed we are.
Mainly music, although, I mean, Andy Kaufman, not a musician as such.
Well, he's got his Congo drums, but do carry on.
There is that. So, Zoe Saldana's been in a biopic.
Oh, cool. I bet it's fun.
It's the biopic of Nina Simone, Nina.
Oh, wow.
And we'll go on to see just exactly where this stands in the pantheon of great biopic films.
I am very happy we are talking about this film.
Lovely stuff. What have you got for me, brother?
Well, I've gone for a little known... The punchline is Avatar. I can't believe you've not seen Avatar. We're going to be
There is a very good reason why I haven't seen Avatar.
James Cameron?
That is part of the reason.
Fair enough, we'll talk about it next month. But yeah, massive, great, big box office smash hit. Or is it?
It absolutely was.
But is it any good? We'll find out next month. I mean, it must be pretty good. Anyway,
it was successful. You cannot deny it was successful.
You cannot deny the success. And in what part is that down to Zoe Saldana puppeting a blue cat for Pocahontas? Anyway, more on that.
Something like that.
Next month.
Yes.
And then the joint review, which we are going to cover in our episode about Zoe Saldana, covers her Oscar-winning role in Emilia Perez.
Ah.
Again, is it a good film? It has some controversy.
I've heard things.
But she won an award.
Indeed she did. An Oscar, no less. So there we are. So we will be covering next month Nina, Avatar, and Emilia Perez. So if you have thoughts on those films, or let's be real here, people. If you've got thoughts on her as Gamora or Uhura in the Star Treks, because I think there are some Star Trek fans who listen to this, what with Patrick Stewart to be our featured actor this year. write in at hey@earth-2.net or give us some feedback on the Facebook page. And you too will have your feedback half remembered right at the end of the episode. And we're going to listen to it now. Here is our Danny DeVito feedback. From the Orcs.
Splendid. Splendid.
Hello, Brothers Wilson.
Hello.
Hope all is well. We thought we'd give our thoughts on Danny DeVito. Fans of him in this house, but mainly thanks to Taxi, I think it's fair to say. Which we recently got the DVD box set of, because I'd not seen it since I'd still living at home, which is many centuries ago now.
I'd never seen it before.
And he's just so amazing in it.
Yeah.
It's one of the all-time great sitcom characters. Just incredible. He manages that lovely balance between really skeevy and horrible, but also lovable somehow at the same time.
Somehow, yeah.
And really funny as well. I mean, it's just, his comedy chops are immense. You are covering Man on the Moon. I liked that film. Until I saw Jim and Andy, which is kind of like the making of documentary.
Oh, God, the guy's a cunt.
Which exposes Jim Carrey as utter... I mean, I suppose he was well cast, but he went all method and was an a-hole, basically.
He says he's an a-hole.
Yeah.
absolute a-hole. Yeah, I'm not sure we'll watch the movie again as a result. And it was a good movie. Romancing the Stone, I saw many, many, many...
I was a child. I watched it many, at my nan's.
Many, 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 many moons ago. Yeah, I was living at home as well. And I wasn't massively impressed. I kind of felt like it was Timo Indiana Jones, basically. But I'm probably misjudging it and ought to rewatch it, I suppose. But there are so many other things to watch, mainly with spaceships in, that I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Uh-huh.
I've not seen Matilda. But you've missed out his best film ever in my book.
Oh, which one's that then?
Zwillinge!
Oh, twins.
Except in German.
Covered that.
Which is the only way to watch it, in the original German. So, back was at school many, 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 many years ago. I went on a German exchange and I had my first ever date.
Yes, has this been Ich bin ein Ananas?
This is Ich bin ein Ananas, yes. Which, of course, every fool knows means I am a pineapple, which is my chat-up line. And got me a date. I mean, it, probably rather more than I deserved with a line like that. But literally, I was just going through the phrase book and saying, Ich bin ein, and then choosing things. And the pineapple was the one that made her laugh the most. So there you go. And yes, we went on a date and we watched Twins, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
And I did watch it a few years back.
Yeah, we did rewatch it, didn't
and
we?
And it's still good, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, it's a bit cheesy. It's got that schmaltz factor that so many American comedies have, particularly in the 1980s. But I think what really makes it is a combination of DeVito and Schwarzenegger. Yeah. The pair are just amazing. Great stuff.
So I also don't like the film much, but like him in it when he's the Penguin.
Yes, Batman Returns. Which is a curious thing. I almost walked out of the cinema watching that originally because Batman 89 blew my mind. It was the best thing since Star Wars. And then I went to see Batman Returns and I was just so, so disappointed because your problem is with it is Batman is barely in it. He's a walk-on part in his own blinking film. It's a bit like those awful Sony Spider-Man villain films that don't feature Spider-Man at all. It's like, why am I watching this? But Batman Returns almost works just because of a combination of Danny DeVito and What's-Her-Face's Catwoman. The combination is pretty good, but they needed more Batman in their Batman film, which shouldn't have needed to be said, but... did, apparently. Hey-ho.
Is Danny DeVito in Jumanji?
Welcome to Jumanji!
He is! We saw him most recently in Jumanji The Next Level, which is the sequel to the reboot of Jumanji, which is a bit complicated, but there you go. I quite like the reboot Jumanjis, I must admit.
Yeah, they're fun.
And he was in the second one, and he's brilliant again in it. Absolutely, I mean, he's aged like a fine wine.
Yeah.
He's really, really good stuff in that, so I hotly recommend that one as well. Good fun. So yes, generally, if it's got Danny DeVito in, we're quite willing to watch a film, basically.
Isn't he in the really awful Throw Mama from the Train?
Never seen it. I mean, I'd give it a go because it's got Danny DeVito in it, but then I might be massively disappointed. I don't know.
I seem to remember trying it and it was terrible.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, perhaps that's the one that will spoil the rule then.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Or it might be like, I mean, I didn't like Batman Returns, same as you, but I liked him in it. It might be that he's all right.
He might save it.
Yeah.
A bit.
Ish.
Who can say?
We don't know.
Who? I mean, I can't possibly work out how we'd find that out. But again, it probably doesn't have any spaceships in it, so...
No. I mean, is he in anything with spaceships in
there? Sadly not. He has not done any sci-fi, which is clearly a big, big fault. But there we go.
So, no spaceships, but does do Batman, so sort of...
Yeah, that's sci-fi adjacent, as far as I can say. I mean, like Batmobiles and, like, nothing on Earth,
Yeah.
He gets a pass.
He does, yes. But he's a good actor, and as a rule, if we haven't heard of a film, but he's in it, we'll try it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Except Matilda. Anyway, Jerry, bye!
Bye!
Oh, some interesting shade at Matilda at the end there.
I know, right?
But that notwithstanding, thank you very much for your feedback, Orgs. And
indeed, but we've already covered Twins.
Indeed. Perhaps that's why they rewatched it a few years ago.
Yeah, we did it for Barney Month, didn't we?
Mm.
Yeah.
Although, I mean...
Oh, well, fair enough.
Schwarzenegger was like year three or something like that.
God blimey.
Let me check. What does the spreadsheet say? Dum de dum dum dum. He was year two. Yeah, so there we are.
Year two. Yes. God blimey.
So 16. But then, we were just, going for anyone at that point.
We were merely children.
We were indeed. You hadn't even had a child at that point.
No.
Yeah, because it was March.
I still had all my hair.
Well, there we go. Cool. Okay.
Well, that was a lot of fun. Thanks, guys.
Indeed. And because a short person has been so well received on Hey An Actor, we're going to announce that the person that we're covering after Zoe Saldana, hopefully the month of April. So for the month of May, again, hopefully, we are going to be looking at films starring Peter Dinklage.
Absolutely. That there, Tyrion Lannister.
And I do mean starring or incredibly prominent. So of all of the actors of his ilk, Dinklage has the best claim for this one. So,
What fun.
It'll be interesting to see what you suggest that we cover for Peter Dinklage Month. And, as I say, you can get in contact with us via hey@earth-2.net. We will be putting something else on the forums. Maybe me, Pandy if not. And then also we have our Facebook page. So, yes.
Yeah.
But, until next we chat, thanks for listening to our Danny DeVito coverage. And here's to a more productive 2026.
We're two in the year so far. Technically one was meant to be the end of last year, but still. Yes. Anyway. Not really.
Here's to a better year than 2025.
Hooray! I mean, that goes around for everything, right? Geopolitics,
exactly.
War.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, bye everybody. Big love.
Bye.
From us small actor friends. Bye.
Martin Luther and the Game of Life. Yeah, 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 yeah. Andy Kaufman in the Wrestling Match. Yeah, 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 yeah. Monopoly 21 Checkers and Chess. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mr. Fred Lassie in a Breakfast. Let's play Twister, let's play Risk. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll see you in heaven if you make the mess. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis? In touch. If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe there's nothing up their sleeve, then nothing is cool. Moses went walking with the staff of wood. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Newton got mean by the was troubled by the horrible ass. Yeah, 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 yeah. Mr. Charles Darwin had the golden ass. Yeah, 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 yeah. Now, Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Hey, Andy, are you goofing on Elvis? Hey, baby, are you having fun? Ghost for the offering. Yeah, 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 yeah. Here's a truck stop instead of St. Peter's. Yeah, 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 yeah. twister in your coffin's gone recipe. Hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Hey, Andy, are you goofing on Elvis?
Hey, baby, are we losing touch?
If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon. If you believe there's nothing up there to see, then nothing is cool.
Well, let's pot in a clip and then let's talk about, well, let's put in a trailer rather. Let's start again. Excellent. So let's pop in the trailer for our next film that we're going to cover, which is all about a certain little girl. Oh, no, hang on. Which? What's next?
It's Romancing the Stone.
Romancing the Stone, okay.
Good say it's about Emma Stone.
Okay, here comes a joke. Okay, so let's pop in the trailer for our next featured film for this Danny DeVito month. And just like a certain Emma's husband, John Krasinski, it's time to Romancing the Stone.
Wouldn't that be Emily Blunt?
Oh, shit.
Good to get the outro then.
Oh God! Who's married to Emma Stone then? Who is Emma Stone?
Who is Emma Stone?
Oh yeah,
the three-time Academy Award winner.
Okay. Oh great! So brilliant. Let's pop. So I came into that way too high. Yes. Okay, let's pop in a trailer for our next featured film then. And just like the three-time Oscar-winning star of films like Poor Thing, Spider-Man, or The Amazing Spider-Man and The Amazing Spider-Man 2, let's do what Andrew Garfield did at some point and go Romancing the Stone.
Nailed it.